bamatros besalinda wena uzufika as one of the most important people. Good morning, honorable members. You are too far from me, honorable Schmidt. I'm not used to you being so far. Maybe
you must fight.
The invited team who are handling some serious matters. The representatives from the companies, especially mainly from the chamber, representatives from the departments, our committee staff, and interested members. I know people will expect we'll talk about our neighbors just across the Limpopo. We have got nothing to say. We just hope things will be normal and back to the interest of the people of Zimbabwe. But we are dealing with quite a sensitive issue which surely it is a matter of interest to many of us South Africans and probably beyond our own borders. Now, I had to be very careful and walk the thin line on this matter. There is something that we know. There is something they usually say, oh my lord, my learned friend, matters of sub judice, all those languages. It is not our intention to enter the courtroom. We are just as legislators more interested, because we have a task and a duty on understanding developments that are taking place. So bear with us. We don't want the merits. We just want to understand mostly the background, but also be able to say what is it that we think we should have done, what is it that we could do, but most importantly, what is it that we didn't know that we should have known or we must know. So it's more of an understanding, so that from now going forward we will be able then to deal with the issues in the manner that are supposed to. One of the things I've said is that for anyone to articulate or stand on a position, it's important first to be educated, so that when someone asks you something, you don't just say, no, don't ask me, ask so and so. You are able to say, this is what we understand to be the situation. But I think secondly on this matter, as I've outlined the first part, We are not sure whether what we did or we sent was correct, but we were made to understand that probably there could have been two processes. And it is precisely for that reason that we don't want anyone who's, as we're sitting here, we're different political parties. But I always remind them that when we are sitting here, unfortunately, our legislatures were given the responsibility. You may not take off your hat, but you may have to apply your mind in a manner that seeks to assist the nation going forward. So we've got no intentions to collapse you, nor be a competition with the lack of a better word. Be a competition who might have done something much better than the other, or which is better than the other. Welcome, DM. Sorry, your missed call arrived first than you. Next time, and Jasmine arrives later. We welcome. It's nice to see you after a long time. Any apologies?
Good morning, honorable members and the guests. I've got apology from Inkosi Mandela. Thank you.
Okay. So the agenda for today is that we will be dealing, again, you'll bear with me, please. Don't put any litigation against me for mentioning the names wrongly. We will be dealing with the two law firms, I assume, but others are in one. And then there will be a follow-up. Next week, Wednesday, because we have to manage time and have more knowledge. Next week, Wednesday, we will also deal with the companies affected as a group, as well as the department led by our dear Deputy Minister of Mineral Resources. Thank you for coming, DM, with your confirmation in presence. Honorable Lorima?
Chair, the program has been changed.
No, it has not changed. We'll deal with it on the minute. It has not changed. Not at all. It's just an addition. So it's not changed. Okay. Being the case as it may, the first one is going to be a briefing by, this is what is written in front of me, Richard Spohr Incorporated, Charles Abraham and Legal Resource Center, on the lung diseases, on the mines and the silicosis class action. Unfortunately, we would have given you all the hours that we have, but we have to share them so that we can also have a difference of understanding. We will then have a briefing. We'll just take a short break, a briefing, so that when we deal with the questions, we can also be able to understand what would be the difference. We don't want to deal with the first session and then later on we realize we have missed something. We then have to go back. So, Richard Spohr and your team, you will share. The discretion is, I'm a very fair person. I give you an additional 5 minutes. You will share your 15 minutes. and then we will take a break. So the floor is yours. You can then also introduce your delegation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You must go there.
There we go. Good morning, Mr. Chen. Thank you very much, you know, for the invitation, and good morning to everyone. I am Charles Abrams. I'm one of the legal representatives involved in the class action litigation. This morning we have myself. Next to me is Mr. Richard Squirr, and Mr. Patrick Schultz, who's also from my firm. And then we're supposed to have a representative from the Legal Resources Center. And just by way of, very brief background, the three entities, law firms, together with the Legal Resources Center, being a public interest body, have been appointed as the class, representatives, for the current class action litigation. What's going to happen is that Mr. Richards is going to give a brief background to the class action when it commenced. Oh, this is Ms. Janet Love from the Legal Resources Center just stepping in. And so we will be giving, Mr. Spur will be giving just a brief background to the class action, how it has started, particularly with one case approximately 10 years ago. Thereafter, he will broadly speak about the actual class action and some aspects relating to the legislative processes. I will speak very, very broadly about some of the progress that has been made with regard to our engagement with the industry, particularly the working group, in trying to resolve the litigation. And I think that if there is anything else, Ms. Janet Love from the Legal Resources Center, will add. So that's just by way of introduction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I'm Richard Squirr, director of Richard Squirr Incorporated, one of the three law firms dealing with the class action. May I begin by saying and I speak informally and unmandated for the other law firms, so don't hold them responsible for what I say, please. We welcome the invitation and the opportunity to speak to you. What we're doing here is we're addressing one of the greatest and most terrible legacies of apartheid. Apartheid was underpinned by gold mining. It was underpinned by migrant labor and the burden of disease and death associated with migrant labor and gold mining over the last 100 years has scarred the subcontinent. It's responsible for the spread of tuberculosis. It's responsible for the death and maiming of thousands, tens of thousands of men throughout the subcontinent over many years. It's widowed thousands of women and it's orphaned tens of thousands of children. There's no question that the economies of the labor-supplying areas, like Lesotho, Mozambique, the Eastern Cape, have been severely scarred by the burden of disease associated with work on mines. So what we're addressing here through the legal system is one of the most fundamental and unaddressed legacies of apartheid. The fact that it falls on our shoulders to do this is perhaps disappointing, although we welcome the challenge and we're doing our best. The purpose of this briefing, as I understand it, is to give you some context to what we refer to as the silicosis class action, although it includes tuberculosis, and some kind of perspective on the legislative framework that we're operating in, with a view of giving you some ideas about what might be done to prevent a recurrence. The class action was certified and authorized by the High Court in May 2016. During those proceedings, the court appointed the three law firms as the counsel for the class. So we don't only represent our individual clients, and between us we represent over 30,000 individual gold mine workers, principally in the Eastern Cape, Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland. But we represent all members of the class. That means all former gold miners suffering from silicosis or tuberculosis associated with their work on the mines. And our responsibility is owed to that broader class, not to our individual clients. The class action itself covers gold miners who worked in one or more of 82 mines that were owned by one or more of 30 different gold mining companies and who've contracted these diseases. The certification of the class action, the order that said we can do this on a class basis, is currently under appeal in the Supreme Court of Appeal in Bloemfontein. That appeal is still pending, and unless we achieve a settlement of this matter before then, it's likely to be heard in April or May next year. Over the last 2 years, the Claimants' Council and the representatives of the six largest respondent mining companies, African Rainbow Minerals, Anglo-American, Anglo-Gold Ashanti, Goldfields Harmony, and Sibanye, who are organized as an entity referred to as the Working Group, have been engaged in discussions with us with a view to settling these claims. We have made significant progress, and to the extent that we're able to talk about that, Mr. Abrams is going to speak to the status of those discussions. It's important to note that any settlement of this action needs to be confirmed by the High Court. The court, the three judges who are sitting there in Gauteng, will not certify this settlement unless they believe it's in the best interest of the class. There will be an opportunity for third parties, interested parties, to make submissions to the court regarding the settlement before it is confirmed. Even once it's confirmed, the settlement doesn't bind everybody. Nobody is forced to participate. And there is a process whereby individual miners who believe that the settlement doesn't adequately serve their purposes have the right to opt out of any settlement. In parallel with the negotiations around the settlement, there have been discussions on a multilateral basis with government, including the Department of Mineral Resources, the Department of Health, and organized labor around the litigation and critically around the possibility of legislative reform of the statutory compensation system. So to the background, we've got two workmen's compensation systems in South Africa. We have the Occupational Diseases in Mines and Works Act, the DIMWA, and that compensates mine workers and the dependents of mine workers who've contracted specific diseases associated with exposure to dust in mines, and it compensates those people only. And that law is administered by the Department of Health. The other law with which most people are more familiar is COIDA, Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Diseases Act, which covers all workers for all injuries and all diseases, but just not mine workers with lung disease. For convenience sake, we refer to these dust mining-related diseases as compensable diseases. They include asbestosis, caused by work on asbestos mines, silicosis, which is most commonly encountered in the gold mines, coal workers' pneumoconiosis, which is prevalent in the coal mining industry, and chronic obstructive airways disease, or COPD, which is associated principally with coal mining, but is also encountered in other kinds of mining. We're also dealing with tuberculosis, which is in some senses a complication of these diseases. We know that if a worker is exposed to silica dust, his risk of contracting TB is much, much higher than it would otherwise be. So these diseases and dust go hand in hand with tuberculosis. Adimwa is quite a lot older than Khoida. It goes back to the old Transvaal republics. The 19th century, there was the first legislation passed to compensate mine workers who developed these diseases. The workmen's compensation legislation, which covered injuries at the time, only came in 20, 25 years after the first mining disease legislation was passed. One of the reasons for the difference lies there. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, people felt that diseases in mines were an invariable and unfortunate consequence of working in the mines. You worked in the mines, well, you got reasonably well paid, but you got sick, and unfortunately that meant you couldn't work, you couldn't support your family, and in many instances you died and you left widows and orphans, and that was a problem for the state, and that was a problem for society. So the legislation was enacted to take care of the widows and the orphans and these sick men who couldn't work. It was social welfare legislation. It's fundamentally different from workmen's compensation legislation, which is insurance that replaces, that is a form of insurance. Employers buy insurance, employers' liability insurance, and workers who get sick or injured on the job get compensated under this insurance scheme. Adimwa is different, and we'll come back to that shortly. So Adimwa is welfare legislation, as it was originally conceived, and it's still pretty much structured in that way. Before Khoida, workers had to sue their employers. If they were injured at work, they had no remedy unless they could prove that the employer was negligent and they could make a court case against them and recover damages. Clearly that was problematic for workers because litigation is expensive and difficult. It was also not that good for employers because a big damages claim against them could bankrupt a small business quite easily. And that led to what we refer to as a historic compromise between labor, business, and the state, where we created a statutory insurance scheme in terms of which workers could claim compensation if they were injured at work. The employers funded the insurance scheme, and the state and certain private entities, in particular two mutual associations, Rand Mutual Association and Federated Employers Mutual Association, were then licensed along with a compensation fund to provide this insurance to workers against injuries at work. Another big shift with Khoida was that the requirement to prove fault disappeared, so it became no-fault insurance. So if a worker was killed or injured as a result of his own negligence, that was fine. He was still covered by Adimwa, by Khoida, I beg your pardon. Now, the value of the benefits under Khoida and Adimwa have varied over time. There have been periods when the compensation was quite good. Interestingly enough, the best compensation payable under Adimwa or its predecessors was in the late 1940s when the Smuts government wanted the vote of white workers, and they offered very generous benefits to white miners and their families in terms of education, scholarships, health, and even the allocation of plots of land and vocational training and a huge range of very valuable benefits to white miners and their families who got sick and died of these diseases. But that has fluctuated over time, and unfortunately since 1993, when Adimwa was deracialized and black and white workers were treated the same, the value of the maximum benefits payable under the Adimwa scheme have declined by approximately 80%. So since 1993, the value of the benefits that sick miners get has plummeted. One of the reasons for this is that while Khoida, the tariffs get adjusted every year by the minister through regulation, under Adimwa, it requires Parliament to amend the benefits that are payable. There's only been one amendment since 1993 which bumped up the benefits, I think, to about 20%, 30%. The maximum benefit payable to a worker now is about 105,000 rand if he has got severe lung disease and cannot work. For a moderate form of lung disease, you get 50,000 rand for people with mild forms of the disease. There is no compensation. That sum of 105,000 rand must cover your loss of earnings, it must cover your medical costs, and it goes without saying that for a worker who loses 10 or 15 years of his productive life, who is sick, who has tuberculosis from time to time, who needs oxygen, who needs medical care, who needs hospitalization, 100,000 rand doesn't cover, doesn't begin to cover the actual loss. Now that means that historically, workers and their families and their communities, and in the Southern African context, the countries themselves, are subsidizing the cost of occupational disease in mine workers. They are paying that price. The result is that, so we have a situation where these diseases have been prolific and where workers are carrying the can. Workers and communities and the state, which through its public health system must support them, are carrying the can. In the 1980s, one of the things that has changed in the last years is, I said earlier that the view was that these diseases couldn't be helped. They just happened. Dust, mines, sickness, there's nothing you can do about it. That understanding has changed quite significantly over the years, as have conceptions around occupational health and safety. And in the 1980s, there's been extensive litigation in the United States, in the United Kingdom, Australia, and in other jurisdictions around lung disease. It began with asbestos and has moved on as well to silica, to silicosis, to coal workers' pneumoconiosis, and a range of diseases. So what has happened is that from a legal perspective, we began to realize these things can be prevented, the employers haven't taken reasonable steps to prevent them, and therefore the employers can be held liable. Now, of course, sitting here in South Africa as lawyers concerned with occupational injuries and diseases, we noted these developments. However, the door to litigating in South Africa to get compensation for workers was closed. Section 35 of the COID Act says no employee may institute any action for damages against his employer in respect of any occupational injury or disease. That goes back till the 1940s. So since the 1940s, there's a law that says you cannot sue your employer, period. Your employer may be negligent, he may be remiss, but your remedy is to go to the statutory compensation system. And that has been the law in this country since the 1940s. Now, the enactment of the Constitution in 1994 created scope for lawyers to challenge that. Because clearly it's inequitable. If we think about the mine worker who's become injured, become diseased as a result of the negligence of his employer, the statutory system pays him a fraction of his real damages, why shouldn't he be entitled to recover that damages from his employer? So we began, in the mid-1990s, we began looking at this thing. The first industry that we focused our attention on was asbestos. Why? Because asbestos is well understood. The dangers of asbestos are well understood. Asbestos mining was huge in South Africa. And we began litigation. Well, originally the litigation started in the United Kingdom. So a British firm of lawyers, Lee Day and Company, sued Cape Asbestos in London on behalf of South African asbestos miners. Cape Asbestos said, but you can't sue us in London, sue us in South Africa. The response of the lawyers was, no, we can't sue them in South Africa because under South African law, workers may not sue their employers. And on that basis, the English High Court said, fine, we will accept this case, we will hear this case, and South African workers can prosecute Cape Asbestos in England. However, that didn't help South African mine workers who worked for companies like Glencore and Jeffco, which were South African gold mining companies, who had asbestos-related diseases. So in about 2007, we began, 1997, we initiated litigation against Gencor and Jeffco in the South African courts. That litigation was settled before any judgment was obtained. So this important question, are you allowed to sue your employer, was never answered. But the matter was settled, and that led to the establishment of two trusts, the Asbestos Relief Trust and the Galagadi Relief Trust, which compensate former asbestos mine workers with lung diseases. I think the Deputy Minister, Mr. Olifant, and I have had some relations over the years about the Asbestos Relief Trust and its functioning, but I'm satisfied that this trust has done a remarkable job and has paid out hundreds of millions of rands to sick miners and their families over the last decade. In 2006, I teamed up with Charles Abrams, and we decided to run test litigation to get the courts to determine once and for all whether mine workers with lung diseases had the rights to sue their employers. So in 2006, we issued summons against AngloGold Ashanti on behalf of an Eastern Cape mine worker, Mr. Thembekile Mankai, claiming damages in respect of silicosis. We lost in the High Court, we lost in the Supreme Court of Appeal, but in 2011 the Constitutional Court ruled in our favour and said that we are entitled, mine workers with lung diseases are entitled to bring legal actions against their employers. That then led directly to the filing of this class action in 2012. The Legal Resources Centre, Charles Abrams, and ourselves filed separate actions, which were subsequently consolidated into the single class action. So the question that arises is, why do we use the class action remedy? It's not one that's typically used. Why aren't we just suing on behalf of individual workers? Which is, of course, the alternative to a class action. Well, if we go the individual route, it would mean that there would have to be thousands upon thousands of individual cases by individual miners, mine workers, brought against their employers. It flows that claimants with the best claims, claimants with money, and claimants with access to lawyers are the people who are going to be served first. Which means that former mine workers with lung diseases in Mozambique are not going to get a bite in. People from the Eastern Cape and Lesotho are not going to get a chance. The better claims are going to be brought first. It's also going to mean that the courts are going to be overloaded. Litigation around lung diseases could very easily become like road accident litigation, or these days medical negligence litigation. It could turn into an industry, with large numbers of lawyers all filing thousands of cases, overloading the courts with these claims. That's not good. We think it's not good for workers. We don't think it's good for the courts and the judicial system. We think it's expensive, it's wasteful, it's costly. A class action is the opportunity to litigate once and achieve a settlement that covers everybody, including mine workers in Mozambique and Lesotho and the Eastern Cape, who are not even aware of this litigation that's underway. It guarantees them a fair stake in the process and a share of the proceeds if there's a good outcome. There is a downside to class actions. They are large, they are complex, and they are expensive. We've been busy for 5 years with this litigation. We're now at the stage where we've got certification. That is under appeal. If whoever wins or loses on that appeal could appeal again to the High Court, to the Constitutional Court, could take another 18 months, and then we could begin the actual process of trying this case, which, if it's defended at every step and all along the way, could still take several years, easily 5 years or more to finalize. Our statistics, using the workers that we have as individual clients, show that approximately 4% of our clients, ex-mine workers, die every year. Now, if you go back to when we filed this case at the end of 2012, it means that approximately 20% of our clients have died in the last 5 years. we run another 5 years, another 20% are going to die. If you go back to 2006 when we began with the Mankai matter, that's 10 years and 4% of them dying every year. Probably half ex-mine workers have died since we began this legal process. And that clearly, you know, is seriously problematic. Charles Abrams is going to deal with our discussions with the industry and the progress that we've made to the extent he's able to talk about those things. But I just want to address a few issues to bear in mind when one looks at the likely settlement that comes out of this process, because it is so. There is significant progress towards a settlement. We've been busy with this thing for a long time, talking to the industry. We are hopeful that we can reach an in-principle agreement in the course of this year, and that perhaps in the first quarter of next year, the court might ratify the agreement that we reached. Now, one of the things that I've learned, especially from the asbestos litigation, is that no one's going to thank you for it. You're going to get a lot of criticism from people who say you sold out the workers, in fact, that's the main criticism. We're going to get attacked from different sides around the settlement. So I just want to refer to some of the factors that weigh in a thing like this. The first I want to emphasize is it's an enormous responsibility. We're litigating on behalf of people that we don't even know. Class members in Zimbabwe, Botswana, Lesotho, Mozambique. We've never met them. We can't take mandates from them. We can't take instructions from them. We are discussing and negotiating on behalf of people who aren't in a position to tell us what to do. So how do we address that responsibility? Well, we consult widely. We engage with organized labor. We work with agencies. My firm is partnered with the Dichwanelo Human Rights Group in Botswana and with the Mine Workers Development Agency in Lesotho. Charles is associated with ex-mine workers, Southern African Organization of Ex-Mine Workers, and we work with the Legal Resource Centers, which you know is a renowned public interest organization. We also work with a lot of very senior, capable, responsible lawyers. There's wide consultation, and we take the responsibility that we have assumed as class counsel very, very seriously. We're under pressure to settle because our clients are dying. At the same time, this litigation is also very expensive and costly for the industry. When we went for the hearing for the class action, I think there were at least 60 advocates there, all highly paid, highly skilled people. This weighs very heavily on the industry, and they are under pressure to settle this matter and clear it. We're under pressure, they are under pressure. What does the settlement turn out with? Well, how the settlement turns out depends on a number of things. One is, how strong is your case? Do you have a good case? We believe we have a very strong case. How long can this case be dragged out? Well, it could be dragged out for a very long time. From the defendant's side, how willing are they to settle the case? Again, that depends on their assessment of its merits, the risk, and affordability. If we're going to enter into a settlement, we need an agreement. The industry has to agree. So any settlement of this litigation requires agreement between the parties. You have all these factors weighing in, and the outcome has to reflect a just and equitable balance of all these different considerations. Expedition, cost, affordability, the merits of the claims, and a whole lot of factors bringing together. It also relies heavily on the buy-in from our social partners in this litigation. They need to be directing us, supporting us, giving input, saying, yes, do it, don't do it, hold on, hang tough. And that is an ongoing and very dynamic process that we're engaged in. Charles will tell you how that process is panning out. Now, turning back to the challenge of occupational lung diseases in mines. Look, you know, conditions of the mines are substantially better than they were at the beginning of the 20th century. The Leon Commission of Inquiry in 1994, however, found that dust levels in the mines hadn't been substantially improved for the last 30 or more years. So clearly in 1994 there was a very serious problem. We have very sophisticated health and safety legislation in the Mine Health and Safety Act and the regulations regulating environmental conditions in mines. There is, however, a serious problem with the capacity of the mine inspectorate to monitor compliance and enforce the law and the regulations. Prosecutions for non-compliance are extremely rare. In fact, and I'm a person who's worked with this for more than a decade, I'm not aware of a single prosecution of a mine owner ever for a failure to properly control dust in his mines. Not one, never. During the last 10 years, hundreds of men have died of occupational lung diseases. Under South African law, that is an unnatural death. There should be an inquest. There hasn't been a single inquest into a single death of a single mine worker from these diseases the last 100 years. Under the Mine Health and Safety Act, every unnatural death should give rise to a statutory inquiry into the causes of this accident to find out what happened and why it happened and what can be prevented. That's the law. I can assure you, in the last 50 years, there hasn't been a single formal inquiry by the DMR into the death or injury of a mine worker as a result of exposure to dust and disease. So I regret to say that the enforcement mechanisms, which are criminal prosecutions, inquests, and investigations, formal inquiries into these things, they have failed, and they failed completely. That doesn't... Right. Now, let's take a step back and look at this thing conceptually. You can't sue your employer for these things. There are no criminal sanctions, there are no inquiries, there are no inquests. What incentive does an employer have to control dust and make his environment safe? Nothing. The only incentive you have is if there's a criminal sanction or a civil sanction or some other kind of consequence, administrative consequence. There are no consequences. We rely entirely on the goodwill and the efforts and the initiative of the employers to take the steps that are necessary to guard workers. Many employers are doing an excellent job, and I'm not sitting here and attacking them. I'm just making the point that if they do so, they do it out of their own goodwill and out of concern for their workers and their welfare and, you know, to protect their reputation. And in fact, there are international norms and standards to which these employers subscribe, which oblige them to do these things. But internally and from the point of view of the South African legislation framework, there is very little to incentivize employers to deal with these matters. We also know that the compensation schemes provide inadequate benefits. Not only are the benefits paltry, facilities for medical examinations are few, and even once workers are certified to be suffering from these diseases, it takes many years before they have been compensated. I think Dr. Kisnasamy has probably appeared here on several occasions to tell you just how desperate the situation has been, and about his efforts to turn it around and to get these systems up and functioning. I wouldn't be unfair if I'd say this. Post-1993, when the racially discriminatory provisions were removed from the Act and black workers were brought into the Act, the system collapsed. It was previously structured to serve a small group of white mine workers, and black mine workers are brought on board. It collapsed. 20 years on, Dr. Kisnasamy is trying to turn it around, and the industry has made very, very significant contributions and is putting in a lot of money to assist him, and so are the Global Fund and other organizations, to assist him to turn the thing around. Now, one of the things I want to emphasize is there's no quick fix to fixing this compensation system. There's a big difference between these diseases and accidents at work. It takes many years for these lung diseases to manifest. So the guy has got to work for 20 years before you're going to see these diseases. And then when they manifest, they are progressive. They develop, but at different rates and different speeds. So, if you look at Koida, the premium that the employer pays depends on his risk. So they look at the number of accidents and diseases he generates every year, and his risk levy is referenced to that. A Dimwe is different. Let's say a mine worker works 5 years at one mine, 5 years at another mine, 5 years at another mine, and then he gets sick. Who's responsible for that? Where's that money going to come from to compensate that mine worker? Maybe the bad exposure was his first 5 years on the mine, and that the second exposure was minimal, the third exposure was minimal. You can't put the cost of compensating that mine worker on the last employer. There are people who work for mines for decades. Those mines are gone. They've disappeared. If you're now going to simply bump up the benefits and the compensation, how are you going to fund that? You can't look to today's employers to fund this historical burden. So what we have is we've got a workforce there with a burden of disease, a historical burden associated with conditions over the last 20 or 25, 30 years. How do you fund increases in the compensation for that? Many of those people have moved out, they've changed jobs, they've moved to the platinum industry, they've moved to coal, they've moved into non-mining industries. Where do you place the cost associated with these diseases? Because the harm was done a long, long time ago, and it should have been funded from then on, but that hasn't happened. So, increasing and improving compensation is not a straightforward thing. There's another aspect I want to touch on with Adimwa and one of its problems. Previously, Adimwa was integrated with the Minerals Act, and before that, the Mines and Works Act, in that medical testing, red tickets they used to call it. If you wanted to work on the mine, you needed a red ticket. You went to the MBOD, they did the examination, and you had a file at the MBOD. Periodically, you have another examination to check that you're still healthy, goes to the MBOD. When you leave the mine, another medical examination goes to the MBOD. So there's a centralized record of all mine workers who are exposed to dust. However, under the Mine Health and Safety Act, those medical examinations to determine if you're fit to work underground are done by the mines themselves. And because many of the mines use contractors, the contractors do that work themselves. So the records of the mine workers aren't getting to the MBOD. The employers themselves are keeping these records. When these mines go bankrupt, when they close down, when employees move from one mine to another, these records get lost and destroyed. So a system which is predicated on good, solid, centralized record keeping is no longer functioning because there's a disconnect between it and the Mine Health and Safety Act. So if you want to fix a Dimwa, you've got to fix the Mine Health and Safety Act as well. You can't just convert a Dimwa into Koida. You've got to, they need something different. It's our submission, therefore, that my submission, I'm not speaking for the other firms that I'm making proposals about legislative issues, that legislative reform of the compensation system should not be undertaken on an ad hoc basis. What is required is a completely fresh review of the two compensation systems. I can assure you, by international standards, both of these systems, Koida and Adimwa, both of which affect mine workers, are archaic. Koida is 60 years old, unchanged. Adimwa is nearly 100 years old, fundamentally unchanged. It doesn't align with modern understanding of compensation for occupational injuries and diseases. It's old-fashioned, it's archaic, it's unjust, it's not working. We need a new system that ensures that workers are fairly compensated. We also need to ensure that the system works in a way that it incentivizes employers to improve health and safety in the workplace. One of the reasons health and safety records our health and safety record in South Africa is poor, is, I believe, because of the way that our compensation system is structured. Good employers pay the same as bad employers. They subsidize each other, and there's no direct correlation with what you pay towards compensation and how much money you spend improving health and safety in the workplace. We need a system to ensure that compensation is paid quickly. Delays under DIMWA have historically taken years. Widows can wait 3 years quite easily. COIDA, look, there are efforts to improve it, but it still takes much too long. We need to address the challenges faced by the state-run compensation schemes. If you look at COIDA, you will see that the fund is in deep trouble. They are struggling. Recently, they passed historically, Rand Mutual has dealt with mine workers. But recently, they took metal workers and transferred them full scale from COIDA, from the fund, to Rand Mutual. That is over R1 billion of insurance premiums per annum just transferred out of the public sector into the private sector. I don't think the PFMA was complied with. I don't know how that decision was taken. I don't know if there was Treasury approval. But it happened because COIDA isn't managing. Because they are struggling, they said, guys, Rand Mutual, please take over. You deal with metal workers. The systems are creaking. They're under a lot of pressure, and they're not working particularly well. We need to be alert to what is happening, which is a kind of a creeping privatization, which is the transfer I've just referred to of workers from the compensation fund to Rand Mutual. Rand Mutual does a better job. They're more efficient. They're more effective. But we need to be alive to it. We need to know what this means. One of the problems we're finding is that historically the Director General was the person you appealed to if you weren't happy with the decision of the fund or you weren't happy with the decision of Rand Mutual for compensation of a worker. These days, if you've got an objection with the decision by Rand Mutual, you appeal to Rand Mutual. You appeal to people appointed by Rand Mutual. You don't go to the Director General anymore. Now, so what is happening is Rand Mutual is now its own judge. It is the party that hears appeals against itself, which is clearly not a satisfactory situation. We also need, I believe, to take steps to ensure that the courts have better and closer supervision of the functioning of the compensation schemes. For us to challenge a decision of Rand Mutual or the Compensation Commissioner or a DIMWA, to get that into a court can take 8 years or more. And during that time, that worker is prejudiced and suffers enormous harm or loss. We need to make it easier to review and check and police the compensation system. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for the time. That's what I wish to say. Thank you.
Oh, okay. In my fairness, gracefully, you exhausted your 50 minutes with an additional 5 minutes. But as a generous person, if there are any additions in 10 minutes.
Mr. Chair, in fact, mine was only going to be 5 minutes, simply because of the nature of what I am speaking about. It is currently under, you know, discussion, and it is confidential. But I thought that we thought that it is useful just to give a very high level, you know, idea. And then to the extent that Ms. Janet Love from the LRC might wish, you know, to add, you know, I'd really like her to do so. I want to say that, you know, after the commencement of the class action litigation, you know, to the credit of the companies, you know, we've sued in the form of the working group, they were quite quick to reach out to us and, you know, and began a process of, you know, some serious discussions with the aim at trying to resolve, you know, this matter. The discussions have been ongoing for a very, very long time, and I can say that I think that the parties have made significant progress insofar as it relates to, you know, a resolution, you know, of the matter. I would want to say that Once a resolution is achieved, obviously that would have to be sanctioned first by the named claimants, you know, we represent, as, you know, part of, you know, the class action. And once that has been approved, you know, by them, the matter invariably, or the settlement or resolution, will then have to go to court in order for the court to give its final, you know, sanction, you know, to it, you know, or otherwise. But it's perhaps, you know, fitting just to indicate that, so the parties, you know, to the current settlements are obviously the claimants involved in the, you know, class action, and they're currently represented by ourselves, you know, as legal representatives, and then, of course, the mining companies, particularly in the form of the working group, and I'm not saying the working group, because not all of the defendant companies that, you know, are being the object of, you know, the suit are, you know, part of the, you know, working group. There are one or two, you know, who are, that are outside, you know, of that. The settlement envisaged the establishment, you know, of a trust, of a fund trust, an independent one, which essentially will provide compensation to miners with silicosis and miners with tuberculosis. Now, I want to just, you know, very quickly stop, you know, as far as the issue of tuberculosis is concerned. My colleague has, in fact, mentioned that TB is a, you know, complicating disease in the sense that, you know, once you have contracted silicosis, you know, invariably you might be at risk of also contracting tuberculosis. And that's how we understand, you know, the science. But the very interesting feature of this litigation has also been TB independent of silicosis. And that has been a very challenging and a complicating, you know, feature of, you know, this particular class action, where TB as an independent disease, independent of silicosis, has been part of the litigation. I can probably say that, you know, one of the reasons why this matter has principally been opposed, you know, by the industry, and without, you know, speaking for the industry, is simply because whereas silicosis has a direct nexus to silica dust, tuberculosis is one that, you know, does not necessarily have the direct nexus, you know, to, you know, to silica dust, because tuberculosis is an airborne disease, it can be picked up, you know, anywhere. And we are mindful of the fact that, you know, as, you know, my colleague indicated, that that is one of the things that if this matter should, you know, proceed with on appeal, etc., or eventually gets to the point where it's been litigated, that it could go on for years. TB is one of those, you know, aspects. One of the things that I can say is that, notwithstanding that, we have really made significant progress to add TB as an independent disease and making that part of the disease settlement, particularly in the context where TB has, you know, caused, you know, lung function impairment, you know, or harm to the individuals. And we are quite, we're saying that, you know, just from that, you know, particular perspective, you know, that we are very happy in terms of the strides, you know, that have been made, you know, to try and find an all, you know, encompassing solution. The important, you know, idea of this trust is that, you know, its key focus would have to be to track and trace. Now, in this regard, I want to say that during this process, we've established a relationship with the Department of Health, HEMBOT, particularly Dr. Barry Kitson-Sammy. We've had, you know, numerous, and we're engaged on numerous levels. The department has been very, very supportive in, you know, acceding to our request, you know, for information on behalf of our clients. And, you know, other than that, we have also, you know, engaged, you know, the department on its own processes, you know, where it's currently embarked together with the support of the industry, you know, on a track and tracing of, you know, its own miners, where compensation under the ODIMWA scheme, you know, are due, you know, to these, you know, miners. The idea of, you know, this envisaged trust is to align it with what the department has already has done and is doing and envisaged, you know, to do. Those discussions, you know, are taking place, and the idea is to ensure that we don't have unnecessary parallel structures, but where we can amplify and where we can add, this is ultimately how we envisage, you know, the interaction, you know, between what, you know, the importing is currently doing and, you know, how we see, you know, the envisaged trust, you know, unfolding. The, we envisage, you know, the trust to have a lifespan between 10 to 15 years. Those are aspects that we are working on. And, you know, I've already indicated that once we have, you know, certainty, you know, around, you know, the terms, and it is accepted, then, of course, you know, we will head back, you know, to court for that to be made in order of court. My colleague has briefly indicated that, you know, there are those, once the court has made an order of court, those who do not wish to be part of it, they will have the opportunity to opt out, and then they can pursue their, you know, litigation or, you know, their claims, you know, separately. So that's, you know, my contribution as far as that is concerned. I don't think Ms. Love wants to add, you know, anything in particular.
Thanks very much, Charles. Chairperson, good morning. Sorry, I was a little late, thanks to your Cape Town traffic. Chairperson, just a couple of things to add. I think, first of all, the issues around the legislative framework are very are extensive, not only in the context that Mr. Spoor has mentioned, but I think generally around conditions within the mines and the obligations to monitor health profiles and keep records and make those available. But that is not, as I understand it, the subject of what you're interested in today. So we have not anticipated dealing with that. Having said that, though, I think that there are a couple of things in the history of this litigation that are worth mentioning. And in particular, I think it's worth mentioning the role of the Legal Aid South Africa, which has worked together with the Legal Resources Center for 11 years before this class action litigation took place, in preparations and then finally the actual commencement of the case and subsequent negotiations that dealt with Anglo-American and pulling together something in the order of about 300,000 pages of evidence. And I'm saying this because it's based on that evidence that I think the issue of responsibility of the companies and the actions of the companies is really at this point very, very well documented. Having said that, I think you've heard that there's a real willingness by a number of companies to engage on these issues, but we do need to note that there are some significant companies that have not agreed to participate that are part of the class action. So much as we would all like to hope that a settlement that might arise will bring relief much more quickly to many, many more people, there are some mine workers who unfortunately would not be accommodated by that agreement and may well have to still seek the benefit of the class action ruling by the court in order to then have the opportunity to either remain and opt into the class or, as has been stated, opt out. The last thing that I wanted to mention, Chairperson, is in relation to the other players, if I can call it that, in bringing about some solutions. It has been mentioned, and it's hugely appreciated, the cooperation we are receiving from the Department of Health. That said, many of the delays that have happened in terms of taking things forward around getting compensation for miners is as a result of real problems within the health system. X-ray machines not working, personnel not present. I'm saying this because I really believe that if we are to achieve a situation where working people are able to receive a level of health and security, we can't only deal with it from the one side. We really have to address the issues of the health department on the other side. And I hope the committee will give that some attention. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a 5 minutes break. To adjust our minds.
No.
You know this thing, I wonder now will we finish it here. Now it's the time. Because we must then explain why can't we discuss if we finish playing. So if we have to continue, even in Tuesday, I will ask for an extension. If we don't, we'll ask an extension only. Because we'll end up for 2 hours. If I'm Melani, in an hour. So why do we need to continue? Let's just agree on this one, will not be in agreement. And we may even finish on Tuesday, depending when you finish with the minister. So if you finish with the minister at 11, or even at 12. And we don't need them at Tuesday, because
the problem is why the house chair, when I spoke to him, he said, what if we finish at 11 or 12? Because we are continuing from where the meeting is. Now, what if then you finish at 11 or 12 and you ask questions? What will be this week? Two, if you finish at 12 or within that period, what will be that if you have to more than an hour or a certain period? But what becomes unfair is that which I didn't know about the honest myself on my side, I didn't know the impact. So if you deal with this thing with just one guy, those ones, the lawyer and others, and then you don't want the company affected now, you are actually coming back next year, probably March. And by that time, perceptions in the public domain were never given their fight of this. So we're trying to squeeze so that they can also be able to give their side of the story immediately. After this, you those companies that are in class action. Yes, but also the departments that are working with it. So now we're trying to balance between those two. So now, when we, for instance, that's why I wanted to see this. So when we started to call this, those companies are also demanding. Yeah, that's what. So we're trying not to do something a little bit fair. You can't put all four of them. The lawyers, both of them, we still have to see what is the difference between all of them. That is the two sides of the law. Then we've got the company itself with the many of the departments which we might also complain with it, but we have to claim them together because they're working on one thing for the decision. We might even get a grievance when you are done from labor to say, but why you didn't invite us? So we are trying to balance between these two.
All right. So we can try and balance, at least get some balance for the next session, but to also say that the official is going to come back to it and not just.
My take is that we must try and push that we finish our side on Tuesday. If we don't finish on what has to be done, we then come back again. We deal with the questions that we have not finalized. If we can, we finish on Tuesday. But if we can't, we then have to come back on Wednesday and then take more than an hour. Either way, either before or after, then you may ask for an extension. Instead of finishing at 12:30 or 1 o'clock, we then say, give us up until 12:00 because the sitting room is at 5:00.
Because my expectation is that if you don't use those companies, they will have everything.
What you did to the court was to accept so many false documents.
No, some of them, that they said they wanted to come and you remember what I said? I said, depending on the presentation, you know, we may then have to ask the company to return department. So they said, no, I said they will come to deal and also make a presentation. And I think that's why.
I sent it to your email and I spoke to Nangam Kuan. I'm going to
you
tell you what I'm saying is that you have to ask.
But
your email has the wrong documents if they're not
you need to get to the whole spectrum.
Yes, depending what it
is. My phone is on the next
I'll have to check.
Yeah, but
I don't want to
find
that.
You can't hold it.
I'm
in the
first.
No, that's why we say we try by all means necessary to condense everything, even if it's touching on what is going forward. And then when we give them time, and at least we also have to have a hand of the because we are not sure what that is. The problem is that you must also send it officially. In the same way you have that discussion in the military, you must send an official invitation to them to prepare a presentation.
But they prepared.
It's okay. We will check that. Zagit. Are you people ready to present today?
No,
no.
not.
No, I'm saying if we were, we want to say.
No, but if there are questions, you sound very excited, but we are having a committee next door as well, and we can all hear anything.
Oh, okay. Sorry, can we be fair to our neighbors next door? We hope and wish them also they will do the same when they take a break. Thank you very much. The enemy of progress is time. And sometimes when people are given a chance to take a break, it takes time for them to come back. Probably next time I won't give the 5 minutes. Because we put one in front of the five and then it becomes 15. Thank you, honorable members. Babuku, the 45 minutes is yours. Let me explain why it's 45 minutes. It's because you might have disadvantaged yourself by writing only Kulu Incorporated. So others had an advantage because they split themselves into three. So we had to accommodate so that they don't come back and ask us. We'll then say, in that three, we just added a 5 minutes only, which we had to extend. Otherwise, they may have got 15-15 each of them. So your 45 minutes, I think it will be sufficient. We will then talk about what then becomes the way forward to handle the matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the honorable members. I've tried to be technologically savvy here by providing a PowerPoint presentation. Thank you to Mr. Spohr and the Human Resources Center and Charles for providing a background to this matter. Maybe let me start by introducing our firm. Our firm is a small firm based here in Cape Town. It's a human rights practice, which is not a fashionable, so I put it that way, practice for African lawyers in particular. I'm mentioning this because at one stage Mr. Spohr was highly criticized in the public for saying that. The firm works with communities across the country. Here in the Western Cape, I will mention one of the
famous cases that the firm has been involved in or was involved in. The firm represented the Makhaza community in respect of the open toilet. This was the open toilet that were constructed by the city of Cape Town. And we were supported in that case by the Legal Aid Center. I must also acknowledge that. Then as we're interacting with the firm was successful in getting those toilets enclosed, because it was the most inhumane thing that was ever done by the city of Cape Town. As we're engaging with communities, we discovered that actually there were a number of other human rights violation issues that are unattended, and amongst them was this issue of ex-miners. You'd be shocked to realize that most of these informal settlements, in particular here in the Western Cape, are consisting of ex-miners. Originally, they're coming from the Eastern Cape, they're coming from Lesotho, but they flock to Cape Town trying to make a different living. And we discovered that most of them now have got these unattended issues. It took the firm to do quite a comprehensive research to establish exactly what's an extent of this problem. And that is why the firm now has clients across the SADC region, in a sense that we've got clients in most of the provinces here in South Africa. We've got clients in Zimbabwe, we've got clients in Mozambique, and we've got clients in Lesotho. It's quite a task for a small firm, and we were joined by the Irish law firm called Coleman Legal Partners to pursue this task, because it was too big for a small firm, and to coordinate it, and also the resources that were required, taking into account that the ex-miners are the most vulnerable clients that you can deal with in terms of affording, from transport money to getting into your office. It was quite a magnitude task for a small firm to handle. So we joined forces with Coleman Legal Partners, which is the law firm that is based in Dublin, Ireland. I've got Mr. Dave Coleman with me here, who is my partner in this, in particular, in this case, who have assisted and supported the firm, because that is his also specialty, dealing with large group cases, not only in South Africa, in other countries, including his own country, which is Ireland. We are also supported by highly skilled paralegal and other lawyers who could not make it to this session, but who are with us in support and in their hearts. We know that they are with us for this important occasion. Thank you for the committee to recognize at least that, you know, we have been doing this work also for the past 5 years. We have been to the Department of Health, and we didn't get the recognition that we thought we were going to get. We've written several letters, at least to get recognition. I hear here, I mean, the Legal Resources Center and Richard Spohr acknowledging that there is, in fact, a relationship that exists between them and the Department of Health. We don't know the basis of this, of excluding us, but we represent the ex-miners in a similar fashion as Richard Spohr and his associates are representing these ex-miners. But maybe it's still the continuation of inequality, because we have not been given a platform that basically gives us proper recognition in terms of aiding our views, how we think this matter should be really handled. before us, or before we make this presentation, Mr. Richard Spoh gave a whole history of the system of compensation that is in existence in this country when it comes to X minors. I know that the invitation was very specific. Talk to us about the lung-related diseases and the compensation system in this country. As I've said, that the firm works with communities. When we attended to this problem, we did not only look at the lung-related diseases and the compensation thereof, but we looked at a number of other areas where ex-miners has to be, or our clients, has to be compensated on lung diseases, one of them, UIF, one of them for mainly for those who are South African, the Provident Fund, Koida and Odimwa kind of compensation. You know, I must here commend Mr. Spoh for the work that he has done. This we came in after he has already started this work, even though we've never, you know, the same table, but and we are aware that he's also aware of our existence because we've done this differently. In a sense that for all four categories of related cases, we have individual clients registered with the firm, in a sense that any client, whether it's a client that is loaded in terms of money, were to walk on to our firm, we will figure that particular client, so that we know exactly who is this client that we're dealing with. We'll have the address, where the client is coming from, we'll have the contact numbers, we've got the identity number of the client, we'll have proof that indeed you stay in a particular shack or in a particular village in Lesotho, a confirmation of your residence. So all the requirements that FICA really requires. That made us to be really on the ground and be in constant contact with our clients in the form of SMSs, updating them on it, all milestones that we are making, including the milestone of starting the settlement negotiations with the mining companies, in particular the working group. So our clients are kept informed of all these developments. Besides the communication which is made in the form of SMSs, we also have sessions where we will travel and get into these remote areas across the country and inside the countries to deal with these issues. When it comes to the case of silicosis or lung-related diseases, our intention was simple, what Mr. Spoh has referred to as going to clock the court system. We intended to clock the court system. We were issuing sermon in respect of each and every mine worker, ex-mine worker. But when we started the negotiations, there was an understanding and the agreement with those that were negotiating with that it is not worth it. It was, yes, a very expensive exercise, but we were prepared to pursue it in that fashion. And we started the negotiations almost 3 years ago with the working group. When it comes to the issue of UIF, the Department of Labor, has been very difficult. We ended up taking them to court. We have an order which they are complying with as and when they like to comply with at the moment. They are paying the ex-miners a portion of the UIF money as we speak. And again, we pursued this without any benefits in a form of legal fees paid by these people or taken from what they've received from the UIF, because we know about the bigger picture and the access to justice that these individuals have been deprived of. The other area, which is for the wealthy and the rich, provident fund, pension fund, we have been having ins and outs with the pension funds, mine workers, provident fund, for a period of more than 4 years now. And we have finally decided, obviously with the instructions from our clients, which are based in those areas that I've mentioned or in the countries that I've mentioned, and that we have to pursue this thing in court. And part of the bundle which was given to the members, you see there was all that was attached to the the notice of motion, which shows that in 2015 we ended up deciding to pursue this matter to court. You know, the issue of inequality in this country, and mainly when it comes to individuals like the ex-miners who don't have big pockets and who don't have political power, is disturbing in a sense that you see in our on this bundle, bringing this to the members, when we issued the notice of motion against the program funds, it was in 2015, April 2015, when we issued. The pleadings have been closed. I don't know whether the language is clear, but the pleadings, the exchange of papers between the parties, between us and the following mining companies, the 1976 Mine Workers Program Fund, 1989 Mine Workers Program Fund, they've been closed for at least more than a year. Because we are vulnerable, they are not recognized in the society as like other political parties or big civic organizations with lots of money. We have not been able to get a date. Just to obtain the date for the court to adjudicate on this matter, we have been in and out making this specific request, and we've been struggling just to get a date for the matter to be adjudicated. But we're still pursuing this matter. It's a matter that is still pending in court, coming to the Provident Fund. The most unbelievable stance that we've received from the Provident Funds were, you should become our tracers. You can't represent these people. Which is the same stance at one stage I've received from the deputy minister. I think if he's still here, I was going to tell him that when I stood up in a symposium that was organized by the Department of Health in Johannesburg, and I was invited by the Minister of Health, dealing with TB and other lung-related diseases that are actually can be contracted in the mining industry. I was told, you are not an ex-miner, who are you? How can you represent the ex-miners when you are not an ex-miner? You know, it's a very same attitude that has been adopted by the provident funds or the pension fund organizations, that the ex-miners should be the one that are handling these matters on their own. And you see in this slide where we deal with challenges, that amongst the challenges that the ex-miners are facing in interacting with this archaic, to borrow from my colleague here, Richard Spohr, the archaic system, they are expected to go to Johannesburg when they've been sent back to their rural areas where they've been fetched with buses and trains, and at this stage also guys who are even outside the country, to interact with the system in that they must fill in the forms. They must provide the documents that are justifying their claims against the mining companies or against the Provident Fund. These people are not equipped education-wise. They are not equipped with any skills which relates to that. Now, to deny them a right, at least to be represented by a qualified lawyer, it's a violation of their basic rights. And that is what, in fact, we have been even pursuing with the Department of Health to say, looking at Odimo cases, can you at least allow us? We have the information. These are our clients. Just interact with us to establish exactly all the necessary details so that we can have these claims quickly settled. Because when we register each and every client, we also take the medical records and align them properly in the file. So this will be making a case very easy for the Department of Health to deal with these Odimo cases that we are currently having. But we've just been denied any cooperation. And that's why I said I'm happy that they are here. Maybe I'll be getting a positive response from today onwards. Yes. I think that's the job that is supposed to be done by this committee. The system of compensation, as I've identified the four categories of cases that we are currently handling, requires really an overhaul. And an overhaul will only require actively involved organizations, human rights lawyers, and other bodies that have really been on the ground who know what is this animal looking like, you know, the difficulties that we've experienced, even as educated, qualified lawyers, just to deal with the system. And you think of someone who didn't go to school, now is sick, now is in a remote area to deal with. It's not an easy. It's not going to be an easy system. That is why when we decided not to follow the class action route, there are a number of disadvantages that we have seen in the class action system. One, there were no clear rules in South Africa to deal with class action procedures. The rules up in this country are being made as you go along when it comes to class action. It started with a case in the Eastern Cape which recognized a particular group of social grants as a class. It went on to the constitutional to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and the Constitutional Court confirmed it. But there are no clear-cut rules like in other jurisdictions. If you were to go to America and talk of class action, they'll tell you exactly what kind of steps that you have to follow. And it is clear even the public is very well educated around it. It was not therefore an enticing procedure to adopt. And we are aware that there is a firm or there are firms that are pursuing it in that fashion. As a result, we wrote a letter to the CE of Anglo-American sometime in 2013, who then introduced us to his lawyers then, or the Anglo-American lawyers then, were Weber Wenze. And we started this talk, which made sense that, I've made a famous quote of Churchill the former English or England Prime Minister, Jojo Owowo. We believe that Jojo was the best way of dealing with this matter, in a sense that engagement between the affected parties and us as lawyers representing the ex-miners would really provide a sensible solution to the ongoing matter that, I mean, even the NDP, which is an adopted policy in this country, says all those that have been affected in big numbers will have to be compensated or dealt with in large numbers. If the ex-miners, we consider them to be that group which is referred to in the National Development Plan, in that these are just large numbers of people that have been affected by something that is well documented. Everyone knows about the extent of violation of rights of these individuals. And the best way is to formulate a mechanism that is all-inclusive, which includes them, obviously, so that this comes to an end. We don't start this and then when we think we've entered into a settlement, the industries continue with the same thing, or the Department of Health or Department of Minerals are continuing the same thing where they are not really making sure that the laws are adhered to. So we started engagement with the working group. And I must say, the wheels of justice turn very slowly. It's worse for an uneducated and vulnerable individual. We believe in the settlement negotiations that are currently going on. But for someone who has never not been earning for the past 10 years, and the Provident Fund or his claim is outstanding, a month is too long. These negotiations have been going on now for 3 years. We talk real settlement. I share what my other colleagues here have stated, that they are at a very advanced stage, and we believe it's going to happen very soon. But it is very slow for a man and a widow who has not been receiving income and who has to deal with this excruciating disease which is lung related. Now, as I pointed out, that we started getting involved in this case because of our community involvement. It is critical to state the following, that each and every village or country where we have presence, we have been there ourselves. We have addressed the thousands that we represent. We're currently sitting at 21,000 ex-miners, which are formally registered and properly ticketed by the office. We have been there, and we've updated, we've attended to their questions. This includes even countries where we can't speak the language. For instance, in Mozambique, we had to rely on the interpreters. In Lesotho, even though part of our staff understands the language of Lesotho, but we've been there in Zimbabwe, we've been there. What we thought maybe we can share with the committee members are the agreements that we have with established organizations who are ex-miners, ex-miners associations in these areas, and the discussions that we've been having, for instance, with government of Lesotho, they wanted to become part of this arrangement because as the country, they felt they are highly exposed in the sense that they have to carry the care now for health in their health system when in fact this should have been dealt with by South Africa. It's the same thing. We've also had discussions with the Zimbabwean government around the same issue. We've had the same discussions with the Mozambican government. It did not only end with the individual clients or groups that we're dealing with. We've also been dealing with authorities in the sense that in the our local communities we deal with councillors just to say this is actually the situation that we are dealing with and your support will be highly appreciated in that. It's a human rights, it's a human rights issue. Now, you know, it's a minefield in a sense that when you go around and your clients lead you to another, and there are bush lawyers out there who would claim that they can assist these clients. And somehow the system allows these bush lawyers, somehow, I don't know how, but somehow the system allows these bush lawyers and they defraud these clients. And as I've said, you know, we've never asked for a cent from these clients over the years to cover our fees. But instead, we've entered into arrangements that when we're successful, that's the only time we'll be asking you to pay. Now, the bush lawyers, they ask you to pay up front. The bush lawyers, they charge you more than what the law will even require. And as I say, I mean, it's a pity that even the system has not found a way of really dealing with these people because from time to time we hear stories when we are out there in the field. Now, this is one of the reasons why we will recommend that maybe as part of going forward, as part of finding a solution to this, it's important that the Department of Minerals, the Department of Health, whoever that is dealing with this subject matter, that these ex-miners associations are properly regulated. Either they are given the status of being an NPO, but properly regulated in that they don't victimize the already vulnerable ex-miners out there. Because I think it's one of the, they know that they are hoping that every time someone comes in and say, I will assist you, and they just jump in without really doing a proper investigation whether this person is legit or not legit. Thank you very much for everyone. Thank you for listening to me. But what I will do is I will give to Dave Coleman, if there are any, because I still have my time. If there are any, areas that maybe things needs to be emphasized before this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and MPs, for giving us the time to present to you here today. I would like, first of all, to thank Richard Spohr for what he said this morning. He clearly outlined what in fact, we all know, and it's a good thing to do so. Mr. Chairman, this morning you outlined the issues as to what we should have done, what we should have known, and what we must know. And I think it's common cause in the room here that what should have been done was to protect the citizens' rights and various failures, be they from commercial interests or be they from state inability, perhaps coping, as Richard pointed out, with the massive transition from an apartheid state to a fully equal and open society, that the resources were simply not there. It's very easy to change an act of parliament to remove a ban on a particular class of person, but it's quite another thing to put the infrastructure in place to vindicate those rights. So I think that I see the people from the working group here, the representatives, and it's very important that we do adhere to the principle that communication is vital here. It isn't a matter of conflict between current mine owners and their shareholders for the sins of the past or any other reason. It is quite simply an engagement to vindicate the rights of people with those people now in place in those companies. Most of the shareholders are indeed the employees in these mines. They weren't born, some of them, when a lot of these terrible happenings occurred in low standards, massive breaches of human rights that Richard has alluded to. However, we're here now. We're engaging now. And that adage of Jaw-jaw and war-war was contained in a letter that we wrote to Mr. Cutifani from Anglo-American in 2013. And from then on, there has been an open and respectful engagement. Now, granted, we cannot speak to the terms of what we're doing because we're bound not to. However, I would like to place on record that the people we have dealt with have been very, very honest in their dealings, and that we have been proud to serve our own clients by choosing a non-adversarial way to assist to bring a settlement to these discussions and this issue. I think Richard fairly nailed it when he said it could take 10 to 15 years for the implementation of such a settlement, but every day lost is a day wasted, and that we really do need to focus. Whether it is the miner himself or his widow who will receive a benefit is really not a fair question to ask a miner. He should see in his own lifetime that that the wrongs done to him have been vindicated to the extent that they can be vindicated. And another comment of Richard's earlier was that this proposed settlement, it cannot please all people. There will be criticism of it. We've no doubt about that. We share and empathize with the fact that we cannot be all things to all men as lawyers. But as advocates, we clearly are working in an honest and open way with people, and we'd like to continue to do that. I suppose I don't really want to go over what Barnabas has said. The engagement with our clients, though, is really a community outreach approach. In South Africa, as I now have come to know South Africa, and in the frontline states, as the people call them, the communication structures, the resources available locally, they are very poor. And we have to work within that system. And so what we did was we engaged with local people, nurses, school teachers, that type of person. We went and told them how to set up, in effect, a community outreach program. And that is what we did. We have 21 such sites in operation at the moment. And in effect, it's largely volunteer work. It's largely people who know that only by coming together can they vindicate their own rights through their representatives. And I suppose the task in this room here is to understand what it is that people require, what they're entitled to, and how, as a parliament and as their representatives, these rights can best be assisted in their vindication. The vindication doesn't fall solely on public representatives, nor does it fall on private industry, nor does it fall on their lawyers. But it's people coming together that will allow us to actually work closely together and to achieve a real-time, meaningful result for whom we see and we identify as the most vulnerable of people. And their vulnerability has been alluded to by Barnabas here. And it is truly, from an outsider's point of view, and I am an outsider, although I've been made feel very welcome in this country. I even brought you some rain this time. I really feel that, you know, it's for us to do something, do the right thing, and do it in a timely manner. It is very easy to get bogged down in the problems. And the problems have been alluded to as information. Like, in many cases, there simply is no information. All we can do is point to fairly light, sketchy facts, but they can't be backed up with massive documentation of who worked in what mine where. And this problem has been grasped with by us, and I'm sure Richard and Charles have done the same, and with the mine, the working group from the mines themselves. And it's working through the information deficit that truly will allow us to unlock this, and for people to not put the bar too high that nothing can be achieved, or too low that it's meaningless and open to abuse. So with that said, I'll happily answer any questions, and I hope that this meeting will deliver something for these most vulnerable of people in the establishment of new ways to vindicate their rights without the need to do what we've been doing for the past several years, and many others in the room also. Thank you.
Okay. You can switch it off there. Although they are selling each other time in front of me. If I were the judge, I would say, please come to my chambers. Okay, thank you very much with that presentation. I'm trying to be smart. Let me make this confession, sitting here before my honorable members can intervene. I understood the seriousness of the matter. Probably I might have underestimated the magnitude of the matter. You, as learned friends, I'm sure you know that there is something called the natural rules of justice, fairness and equity. I've got a lawyer here, so that we don't share the same political and ideological perspective. So the question is the level of trust. I can't take his advice all the time. It's diluted. But he has never been fair to me to teach me all these linguistics of law. I told him, at least at a crash course, which told me that never question the law, you must ask the law. So he still has to teach me. I've got a sense to just help me, Bab Nonda, and Commissioner, and our dear friend from the employer's side and former employers of what we are talking about today. Maybe it can help and assist. I can get guidance from you, honorable members. My sense is that in order to deal much more holistically, it might help that we get all sides on this matter. The problem with lawyers is that every hour they are sitting, they are calculating invoices. Now, I should have made you to make presentation under oath, so that whatever you do, you know that in Parliament we are unlitigatable. We are immune, but by virtue of being in this room. But I think with the seriousness of the matter, we may not do justice. I understand at least we've got a clearer picture, or in terms of the background, the challenges, the pitfalls, almost everything that has to be done. if I were to get a guarantee, so that when we come next week, we want to give you a chance. When we come next week, you may not be here, all of you, but it might be in your interest to be present. One from the working group, those companies, just a heads up, and then from the department, so that when you come back, you see, there's only one thing. You see, this is another thing. I need to be in the police or defense force in order to know the title. I'll say Mr. Spoor, and then he then says, you are undermining me. I'm a senior counsel, or I'm an advocate. So just for the sake of convenience here, we will use that Mr. Spoor and your team, as well as Mr. Kool. The challenge that we might be having, help me, honorable member, is that we might vandalize your presentation by dealing with you, and then later on come back and ask issues on the basis of what will come from those presentations. Now, what was good about your presentation was that you could talk to it. Something I always teach you, others who come here, Babuzo, and I'm sure you'll take some lessons. Because sometimes people, they come, they can't even see which page they're in because they're reading page by page. To an extent that if you had 20 minutes, you end up having another 30 minutes on top of it. Now, can we get a fence? Just in not more than, so that when you come next week, at least we've got a fence what will be. We want you to come back, also give you almost similar time. So, because we'll be giving you 50 minutes, like all others. Can you deal with your background heads up in not more than 15 minutes? So that when you come back, you will deal with the substantive issues on your input. You see, our politicians, we know that every time before you speak, you start with a preamble. Now we want to hear that preamble first, before the report. Is that correct, honorable member? So that when you come, at least we've got a sense of what is it that we should be dealing with. And when you come back, we can be able to get the facts now in black and white. First, from the working group, anyone who wants to, who's bold enough? Okay.
Mr. Chair, the working group could quite easily give you the background and some of the facts in 30 minutes, which we are prepared to do. But I think this would be complementary to what you've heard as opposed to World War talk.
You're on the road.
Today?
You're on the road, yes.
I'm on the road right away.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, then,
just to give a little bit of background to the working group, I don't charge by the hour, so I'm not a lawyer. I used to be an executive in a gold mining company called Harmony. I served on a chamber committee which was involved in dust, and the Department of Mineral Resources will know my background then. And from that dust, obviously looking at control of dust and the various issues around dust for the miners, I served on that committee for 2 years, and then I was on the committee which was really the CEO's emphasis on safety. So safety and health is a lot of my background.
So that even if I'm on record, let's get the names first.
Graham Briggs is my name.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the working group was then established sort of towards the end of, I think, 2014, and it was established in talking to various gold mining companies, the bigger gold mining companies, which represented what we believed was the most of the gold mining workers. And the mandate was quite open at that time, and it was to try and solve a issue and a problem that in 100 years hadn't been solved. So it wasn't only focused on the sort of topic of today, which is the litigation and the class action. It was focused more generally on silicosis in the gold mining industry. The companies that you've seen have been listed, Richard Spoor mentioned them, I won't repeat them, are members of that Occupational Lung Disease Working Group. And one of the mandates that we worked on was in that working group we should get complementary skills. In other words, we weren't going to have every company with all their lawyers in the room, because then we'd never make any progress. We really focused on complementary skills so that we could get the job done of looking at ideas. So that's a little bit of the background. A lot of work was done on dust control and so on. I won't go into that because it's not the topic of today. I'd like to hand over to Michael, really, to start just talking about the litigation and the subject that you're involved with today. Michael.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My name is Michael Schottler. I used to be an attorney. I'm now in-house at Anglo-American, and I'm part of the working group the working group structure. Graham is entirely correct. The working group was established November 2014. And really, there were three primary objectives. The one was to look at the litigation, the class action litigation. The second one was to look at the compensation system, the MBOD, the CCOD, all under the umbrella of DIMWA. And the third was to see if what, certainly from some of the gold mines, what a vision could be on a large-scale solution. Now, all of that was obviously done in conjunction with meeting the criteria of reducing harm in the workplace, reducing dust emissions, and that was all a parallel process. I think it's quite important just to make it clear that when we talk about the working group, unfortunately, it's not all the current gold mines. So we can't talk on behalf of all the gold mines. We certainly can't talk on behalf of the mining industry because of all the other commodities not being part of us. And the entire mining industry is affected by the Adumwa and the changes, potential changes to Adumwa. And obviously, if one talks about COIDA, it affects every single employer across the economy. So we certainly can't talk on their behalf. But certainly from our side, we've been working quite closely with a number of stakeholders. So there's the sort of litigation stakeholder stream, the MBOD stream, and then the legislative stream with some of these stakeholders there as well. So, Mr. Chair, Richard and Barnabas have provided an extensive overview of the litigation to date. I'm certainly not going to repeat all of those issues. We agree entirely. I think if one just looks at the magnitude of the scope, I think Richard made it clear, the scope of the class action is for every single person that has worked on one of the 32 gold mines over the period from 1965 to date. And one also has to just recall that a gold mine is not a single entity. It's made up of a number of shafts. Each shaft has a number of stopes. The conditions, every stope, every shaft are obviously different, and not only that, but there's been a changing ownership structure over the period. So companies' shafts get sold forwards and backwards, new company brings in new standards. So if one looks at it from that perspective, the litigation is monstrously complex. And everybody's recognized that, certainly in all our engagements with Richard, all our engagements with Barnabas and Dave, and everybody recognizes that extreme scope. looking at one of the first initiatives that has actually borne fruit is the very close cooperation and assistance and support that we've received from Dr. Kitnasamy and the Department of Health. So when Richard gave a background of the two current legislative structures, he spoke about Adimwa, Koida. He sort of referred to Koida as effectively an insurance system, and Odumwa being a social grants type equivalent. I partially agree with Richard, but not entirely, because one has to recall that under Odumwa, it was funded by levies. Those levies were collected, centralized within the department, and then the department used those levies to pay out benefits to qualifying claimants. Those levies have been paid by the mining companies. So one of the important initiatives from the mining company side is we recognize that people are desperate for money to flow out of that system. The mining companies have already paid into that system by means of levies. That there is currently a surplus in that budget simply because prior to Dr. Barry's initiatives, those monies have not managed to flow out as effectively as they could or ought to have. So it's not a proper social grant funded by state. It has, in fact, traditionally and over time been funded by the companies. There may be criticism of that system, but there is an incentive for the companies as well to see that money that has gone into the fund to be paid out. So in conjunction with Dr. Kitnasamy, we've been seeing how we as the working group, so a selection of the gold mining companies, could assist in actually taking those benefits and distributing them to the worthy recipients who were actually supposed to receive those benefits in terms of the system. So what the working group has done is we've committed a payment of 165 million to date, which has gone into assisting the MBOD into the establishment of databases, getting the paper-based system, which was terrible, files sitting in the basements at various buildings, getting all of that computerized, getting IT systems in place, assisting with accounting systems. There have been secondments to the MBOD, not only of chief executive officer, but also medical doctors, because that's another blockage point, the number of people that are actually capable of releasing those funds, and logistical advice. And it's a real credit to Dr. Kitnasamy if one looks at the improvement over a very short period of time. We've taken some of the numbers. In the year to date, October 2015, there were a total of 1,628 payments made out of the MBOD. That's for the year, at a value of 79 million. In the first year where the engagements and the commitments and the money flows came through, we managed to increase that to 3,611 payments at a value of 151 million. And in the last year, we've managed to pay out 7,756 people at a total value of 225. I'll hand out a presentation that has some of the numbers in it, Mr. Chair, if that's easier. But so just in this very short period, we've moved from 1,600 people to 7,700 people being paid per year out of these funds that are already sitting there at a value increased 79 million to 225. And all of these are sustainable going forward because now that the systems are fixed, it doesn't. The system now becomes self-generating and self-improving. So those benefits have been substantial, and it really is an example of the benefit of cooperation between industry, government, other stakeholders, including trade unions, where these results are coming. Just on the litigation itself, we've got, as Richard has pointed out, we are making probably half of the Johannesburg law firms very rich as a result of it. Almost every law firm is involved in this litigation. Almost every senior counsel is involved in the litigation. We have not only the lawyers, there are amicus curiae, so we have the Sonki Gender Justice in Section 27 involved in the litigation as well, who are making representations on certain issues that they believe are relevant and that are assisting in this particular process. Richard is correct. We've made an assessment. If we had to run the litigation, it would likely take another 10 to 15 years to resolve. And that's with best endeavors, not sort of trying to delay with certain procedural points. That's simply best endeavors. And the reason for that is one would have to prove what the working conditions were at each and every stope, at each and every particular point in time, and how that affected employees. So although the companies believe that there are legal merits and considerable legal merits in their disputes, in their defenses, the companies nevertheless believe that it is an appropriate time to work towards a substantial resolution. We have, you know, the substance of the discussions is still confidential and sub judice. We agree with Richard's timing that this should be resolved hopefully shortly. As a result of the progress that was made in the negotiations, the companies making up the working group made certain financial provisions, and those were made sort of between 3 and 4 months ago, and those provisions are made when companies' financial people believe that we are now at a stage where we can assess that if there is a settlement, what would that ultimately cost. Now, the sum total of those provisions that were made, if one adds up the provisions made of the separate working group companies, amounts to about 5 billion rand. And that is for quantum, together with the costs of running the trust system that Richard has referred to. So it's not simply a case of establishing a trust and letting it sit there and letting it die because it's not it's not funded properly, but the contributions, the provisions that the companies have made account for both the benefits that have to flow out of that fund as well as the administrative costs. And certainly it is the intent of the working group companies to ensure that the compensation out of the fund, together with the compensation coming out of the MBOD on a streamlined, efficient system, those two elements of the costs would get to a substantial redress for the affected people. The challenge, Dave and Barnabas have been absolutely clear on that, is information reaching people who might be out there and the like, and we've certainly tried to address those in our negotiations to date. Mr. Chairman, the presentation has some further information about outreach programs that we've done. We have been working very closely with Dr. Kitnasamy, getting outreach programs where we're almost sort of stress testing and piloting some of these projects. An outreach program that was took place over between 6 and 9 November managed to get 4,800 people to that project. All of them were then scanned, their records obtained, and those people are going into the system. So we believe that this can work. The working group companies are certainly committed to making it work. And we believe that the improvements in the MBOD, together with the resolution of the litigation, is achievable and will have meaningful impact. Just on the legislative amendment, we certainly are entirely aligned with Richard, where he made the point that there is no quick fix in this from a legislative perspective. One effectively, in looking at the problem, has to differentiate between three categories of persons. Those minors, ex-minors, who are no longer in service, those who are in service, and those who may come into the mining industry in future. Their risk profile differs. How one treats them from a funding perspective, as Richard said, to simply hike the benefits now simply means that you punish the last man standing, and that would be unsustainable. So any solution would have to look at those as separate or unique individuals or classifications of individuals. There are certain solutions where future mine workers, new to industry, where there has been no legacy exposure, no sort of sins of the past, those persons may be accommodated into COIDA with no significant downside or prejudice to the current industry, and that could probably be done quite quickly. simply taking, transferring the new to industry, that they don't come into the Edomwa system, but that they go automatically into the Koida system. But there is no such quick fix for the past employees who worked but are no longer in service, and there is similarly no quick fix of simply hiking benefits for current employees. The working group, together with the Chamber of Mines, who've been doing absolutely fantastic work in herding the cats that are the various disparate mining companies, are certainly committed to working with your committee, with government, and with all our stakeholders to ensure that we actually participate, that we share ideas, and that we see if we can get to a sustainable solution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I think you heard from Michael and from myself. I mean, there's a real commitment from the Occupational Working Committee to make progress with this. There are other benefits to actually doing this. I mean, besides the amount of money we're talking about, Michael was talking about the nearly 5 billion rand. There is, I believe, something like 3.7 million still in Edomwa to be paid. The value of improving the database, including the record keeping, has meant that other claims for unpaid benefits have been paid. The Deputy Minister has been on the public forum saying that's probably 30 billion rand. I mean, the benefits are huge, and I think it's in our interest really to solve the problem as quickly as possible. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I must go to business. You can, yeah. Can see that presentation was less than 30 minutes. Okay. Now, I think we've got a sense. You want to add? Okay. He's finishing your 5 minutes.
I saw
left.
There was a few minutes left, and actually I'm going to be very short. Tutula Palfo, I'm from the Chamber of Mines. We are very glad to have been invited to this session, and it has been quite informative. Briefly from the Chamber, we appreciate all that has been happening in this sphere. It's quite a complex issue, as we have all heard today. The Chamber is involved with the Gold Working Group in terms of what they are doing, but the legal issues are still privileged. The issues of the settlement, for instance, the Chamber is due to the legal privileging. It's also not part of that, which therefore means that we have a very good but not a complete appreciation of everything, which therefore at the moment means the Chamber cannot have firm views on these matters. We, however, as the Chamber, are committed to having an industry solution. As you will appreciate, this settlement will be for a certain section of employees in the gold industry, and it would mean, as has been mentioned before, that there are employees who would not be covered, and the rest of the other commodities would not be covered. We are therefore still looking for and crafting what can possibly be an industry solution, but this would be very much dependent on where the settlement lands. Regarding the integration of legislation, that is our key area of interest, because that would provide certainty to the industry regarding the compensation legislation. And I think again today we have heard how the impact of the various pieces of legislation has in terms of some of the things fall through the cracks. There is the report that was written by this committee following the visits to the mining provinces, and in that report you had mentioned, for instance, the issue of the risk control. committee which falls between two departments. And I think we have had other examples at this meeting of how it's quite critical that when we adjust any of these pieces of legislation, then we then look at what is the impact and we look at them comprehensively. Therefore, we are still we are involved and are committed to ensuring that there is finality to the integration of legislation or amendments to legislation appropriately. We participate in supporting the MBOD, CCOD. This is something that we have been doing since 2008 through the X-Mine Worker Project, where we committed to supporting the department in setting up and strengthening their occupational health services so that mine workers could go to the periphery places like Nongoma, Mthatha, and others to have their benefit medical examinations. That over the last 3 years has been guided more by the current commissioner, Dr. Kisnasamy, and it has been focused to how to improve the central MBOD, CCOD, so that there is throughput in terms of payment of mine workers. That has improved, but we appreciate that there's still a lot of work to be done. There are still backlogs, and we are still committed to support the department in ensuring those improvements to the benefit of the mine workers. In conclusion, the Chair, as I said, there is still a lot of work to be done ahead, and the Chamber is ready to do that, and we are also quite ready to participate under the Deputy Minister's leadership regarding the changes to legislation, and we look forward to, you know, that this matter should come to some form of conclusion very soon. Thank you.
Zondi and Dr. Kisnasamy.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much, Chairperson. As far as the department is concerned, we have done a lot to make sure that we improve the legislation in the mining sector, to make sure that we reduce the exposure levels of employees in the mining sector. And over and above that, we've also made sure that we invest in the capacity in the department of monitoring the performance of the mining sector. And we have prepared a detailed presentation which Dr. Ndelu will be able to take us through in terms of the prevention measures the department is putting in place.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everybody. The department has got a chief directorate of occupational health, and within the chief directorate, there's a director for occupational hygiene who's responsible for occupational exposures, analysis thereof, and ensuring that the industry complies with certain levels. There's a director for occupational medicine who looks at occupational diseases, does an analysis, and also contributes into the department's ensuring that the industry complies. And we have the medical inspector who is responsible for appeals that are made by mine workers in case they are found unfit for going back to work in the mines, or they happen to be medically incapacitated. There is a section in the Act that allows them to make an appeal through the medical inspector. And the provisions of the Act, Section 13, actually ensures that companies appoint occupational medical practitioners, something that the department has to ensure, and also the companies need to report to the department within 7 days of having appointed the occupational medical practitioner. There's also Section 13 that talks to the establishment of a medical system by the employers who are exposed to health hazards.
And we do collect an annual report based on the occupational diseases, the medical surveillance program that companies have taken. Last year we received about 901 annual reports. There's also the employer must keep a record of hazardous work. This is specific to tell on what exactly each employee is exposed to when they are mining. And there are different HECs. There's HEC A, B, C, C being the worst HEC that people can be exposed to. We have a trend of this over a period of 10 years from 2005 to 2016. We have seen an increase on the percentage of people who work in the safer HECs. A HEC is a homogeneous exposure group where people get to work. So for 2016, there was 78% of employees who were found in this HEC, and in HEC B, there was 17%. HEC A is decreasing from 2015, it was 4.7 to 3.66, and the two figures for 2016 have also increased. That is HEC C moved from 75% to 78%, which I said was the best area to have people working. And then we have the trends for occupational diseases. The silicosis that was reported in 2016, we had 635 cases compared to 1,609 in 2007 and 835 in 2015. For pulmonary TB, we have 2,580 tuberculosis reported compared to 4,516 in 2007 and 3,773 in 2015. We also have promulgated guidelines and guidance notes that have to direct the industry in terms of the code of practice that they have to prepare on how they will go about preventing exposure to employees. There's an airborne pollutant guideline that has been reviewed, and it was reviewed and signed this year. The TB guidance note was signed last year. It was reviewed. A guideline for the right to refuse dangerous work and leave dangerous working places has been promulgated. There's also a guideline on risk-based emergency care that has been promulgated. The guideline on minimum standards of fitness to perform work at a mine. There's another guideline, medical incapacity due to ill health, to assist companies to undertake medical incapacity. There is a whole step-by-step as to how that should be done, because that has been quite a problem before. We also have the improvement strategy, the occupational health improvement strategy that we have created for the reduction of occupational lung diseases. The major challenge is personal overexposure to airborne pollutants, and the initiatives there under we have to do focused inspections and audits. The regional offices have inspectors, medical inspectors and hygiene inspectors who go to all the mines that are there in their regions to do inspections and audits. So we have to look at the health risk management of each mine, look at the system of medical surveillance that each mine has, report on occupational diseases, investigate the occupational diseases, and investigations, depending on the finding, these will then be sent for inquest if really gross negligence has been found through the Department of NPA. And we then, the unit also engages in reviewing research and that is relevant to occupational medicine and hygiene in the country. We also have to have a clear linkage between occupational dust exposures and the medical surveillance records for us to be able, as we have heard that these diseases take a long time before they can actually appear, so we need to ensure that there is a proper linkage between exposure and the diseases. And we do also have audit tools that we have, inspection and audit tools that we have created when we get to the mine. During the summit, there were milestones that all companies, all the industry agreed to for elimination of occupational lung diseases. By December 2024, we're saying all 95% of all exposure measurement results will be below the milestone level for a respirable precancerous of 0.05. Currently, the exposure levels are at 0.1. So we're trying to reduce so that people do not get exposed to high levels of crystalline silica. Saying by 2024, 95% of all measurement results will be below a milestone level for platinum dust of 1.5 milligrams. And also there is a milestone for the coal dust for it to be at 95% of all the exposures to be at about 1.5 milligrams of the OEM. I think, all right, the last one is the prevention of TB. We have a milestone on TB and HIV, but we'll concentrate on TB for here, for now. We are saying the incidence rate should be at or below the national incidence rate by December 2024. Currently, the national rate is at 834 per 100,000, and the industry's incident rate is at 884.
Doctor?
Chair, thanks, and I do apologize to your members and appreciate it. I'm here with Dr. Machali, who's the director of the Medical Bureau. I'm Barry Kisnasamy, the Compensation Commissioner, and I head Occupational Health in the Department of Health, so I have two caps. My minister points out that he doesn't look after the health of pregnant women, the health of HIV-positive people. He also looks after the health of workers, so he is very passionate. Minister Mazzoledi and Deputy Minister Pashla in terms of the health of workers. So firstly, congratulations to your committee for convening this meeting. We last met 2 years ago in Amtata. You visited our one-stop service center, and these are the innovations. So we have four pillars that I looked at the reforms. Let's tell you what we inherited. So quite rightly pointed out by Mr. Spoor, the system had collapsed, I think, probably 50 years ago, notwithstanding the initial thing. Prior to 2010-11, there were 6 years of disclaimers by the Auditor General on this fund. We have not submitted audited financial statements to Parliament on this fund since 10-11 financial year. So you can imagine the trouble that I am in terms of possibly going to jail. But the Director General, Ms. Matsoso, is actually the accounting officer, so maybe I'll join her in jail in terms of not submitting to Parliament. But with the support, so this is the historical context of a collapsed fund that never delivered to our people who built the economy of this country. And we have to take joint responsibility in terms of the governance process. Many of the members around this table were also members of this committee for many years, and it's very sad in terms of the indictment that it took a class action to begin to start stimulating many of these issues and inputs, notwithstanding where we are today. So we're in the final stage of cleaning up the mess. The Medical Bureau did not produce annual financial statements as required by Parliament since 2000, and the audited financial statement for the fund, as I told you, from 2011. And disclaimers have been a problem. We've now moved in terms of, we are doing two sets of financial statements. The, as you heard, the companies have now given me three chartered accountants, because we run a 4 billion rand fund. I never had a chartered accountant before, and I have now, the fact that we moved in the 10-11 financial year, we had a disclaimer, with it's in the final step being submitted, and 11-12 we've gone to a qualification on revenue. So just in 1 year, we've actually moved to a qualification on revenue in terms of the levy. But on the payment side, we've cleaned up our act, and hopefully we'll go to a matter of emphasis within the next year in terms of 12-13, 13-14, 14-15. We hope to clear the backlog by the 18-19 financial year. So we're on track in terms of my portfolio committee chair in terms of moving that forward. So the first issue was reorganization of the compensation system. We inherited 32 rooms of files all over the place. Previously, the disclaimer was that the Auditor General, the disclaimer was they came, they saw, they couldn't make an opinion because 30% of the files were missing. And I have photographs of the files. I mean, it's really chaotic in terms of what we did in terms of the service. Each file represents a claim. And when they are disorganized and you can't find the files, it's a problem. We've had further problems of recycling x-rays, fraudulent x-rays. So Barry Kisnasami's silicosis x-ray gets recycled as Mr. Spoor's x-ray. So fraud in the system, because fraud means money. And unfortunately, Mr. Kulu, that was the problem we had with intermediaries and, you know, the point you raised. And ultimately, how do we work out legitimacy versus... As we're getting on top of the system now, we're beginning to pick up the fraud, the problems, and I've had internal labor disruptions who have been opposing the reforms to the system. Civil servants who oppose reforms that we brought about in terms of the system. So the first issue was reorganization. Three pillars of reorganization, the database. We have a state-of-the-art database, electronic, web-based, and you, chair, and members, constituency work, we want to give you access to the database so that you can look up and see a claim and tell somebody whether they are due a medical examination or whether they've got a claim due. So that'll be made available to you. You've got to sign an agreement with us so that you can't do business with it. Right, but you've got to do it for legitimate purposes. So that's made available partly because of funding 600,000 ex-mine workers across Southern Africa, Botswana, Lesotho, Mozambique, etc. We are then reaching out for the 400,000 files. The point that Mr. Spoor made was originally all the files were kept at the MBOD and CCOD, but then with the review of the legislation, then the mining companies did their own benefit medical examinations. We are collating that back because my act, the Odumo Act, allows us to get any information, and health records are to be kept for 40 years. So we are now requesting the 40 years of health records to be brought back to the MBOD electronic format. That will be continued. We've already piloted with four of the major gold mining companies, and by 31st March next year, 1st of April, we are getting all of the 400,000 workers. So I control 350 mining houses, mines, out of the 1,700 entities registered with DMR. So it's a problem of the Act called this concept called controlled mines and works. But that's for a different legislative process. But for the 400,000, and hopefully Chamber will agree that everybody should come in, because we need a central database, and that's been part of the problem that we've had about tracking our people and reaching out to them. So the second issue was then, how do we actually reorganize and track people and pay them their monies and this thing? Because unfortunately, you can't self-diagnose silicosis. You can't self-diagnose TB. You've got to come into the health system. We appreciate what Mr. Love has said about the issues about a collapsed health system in many instances. So the health system is not collapsed, but the problem is that we don't have occupational health trained doctors. So if a mine worker lands up at Witbank Hospital and says that I want to do a benefit medical examination because some doctors in Joburg want my forms or Amtata, they're going to say, here's a pregnant woman that's going to deliver, here's a stabbed person who's got an injury, and you want to get your forms and go to Joburg. We never heard of the group in Joburg. Secondly, we don't give you chest x-rays to give to somebody in Johannesburg. So that's why we came up with this concept called one-stop service centers. The first one we launched in Amtata, which you visited. And Chair, we are inviting your committee. On the 5th of December, we're launching Kuruman. with the Deputy President, and we hope that some of you can make that. I'm sorry about the late notice, because we had to get, people's diaries are very full these days. But Deputy Minister, we opened Burgersfort 3 weeks ago. So we've got 4 one-stop service centers in South Africa now on decentralized service delivery that looks at all the points that Mr. Briggs talked about. As a one-stop service center that delivers services including unclaimed benefits that might be linked to other pools. We're working with the Chamber of Mines about the mining industry, wider benefit pools of pension funds, provident funds, etc. So Mr. Kulu, we've gone a long way from where we were of a manual system in terms of this, where a person can link up and look at the mine workers provident fund, etc., on our system. In fact, we're having a meeting on Monday which is dealing with that. There are 10 one-stop service centers in neighboring countries, 2 in Lesotho, 2 in Mozambique, 2 in Swaziland, similar to the ones you saw in Amtata. So we have decentralized services, and opposition to that was from our own internal staff who didn't want decentralized services. They wanted people to come to Johannesburg at great cost and all of the problems. So the decentralized services are now functional, and large numbers of workers have begun to go there. With the outreach activities of Deputy Minister Oliphant, who we work very closely with, Minister Oliphant as well, and my minister, and Deputy Minister Inkosi Olomisa, and Deputy Minister Pashla, we've done tremendous outreach activities, and we'd like to invite your committee to probably work with us in terms of next year as we get new funding into the process for outreach and awareness activities. We reached 60,000 people in the last 1 year in terms of outreach activities of making people the rights-based awareness approach in terms of activities. The most recent was Burgersfort when we opened, 1,500 ex-mine workers came up, and we were in Pongola in September with Minister Oliphant, Minister Labour, and Deputy Minister Oliphant, and we had 3,000 people that turned up in that activity. And Kanduli, I'm sorry about the pronunciation, that was reported on. We had 5,000 people turn up 2 weeks ago. And next Monday, we go to Freyr for 3 days, and the following week, we go to Klerksdorp. So these are the things that we put in place in terms of together with the industry, we've said let's make a difference in terms of the process so that we can reach our people and deliver the goods in terms of, so service delivery enhancement. The third aspect was the issue around the legislative reforms. Unfortunately, the Department of Labor, we tried a major process of integrating the two compensation systems. By the way, we have a policy and legislative fragmentation, both in prevention and in compensation. So, Chair, we appeal to your committee. There was a 1999 cabinet resolution to integrate occupational health and safety and compensation in this country. It was never carried through, partly because of dynamics in terms of departmental turf battles, as opposed to how do we improve workers' health and safety in South Africa. So this is very unique in many countries to have multiple fragmented systems of compensation, multiple fragmented systems of health and safety. By International Labour Organization processes, the Department of Labour is the custodian for health and safety of workers. So we should all be uniting towards the Department of Labour for one occupational health and safety law that ultimately reaches out to prevention as well. And that's the approach the Department of Health is taking, that we want to go towards that integrated process as opposed to having Mine Health and Safety Act, Occupational Health and Safety Act, etc. So part of that wider reorganization is your committee would have to probably meet with the two other committees and decide about how you integrate the 1999 cabinet resolution, which was never taken forward. We know why compensation was never taken forward, because our process was in a mess. And the minister at that stage, Mdlana, when he came, Minister Mdlana, he had one look and he said, "Hi, Connor, I can't actually go and take over this system, which is going to collapse my system even further in Quaida." And I told you about the disclaimers and problems and all that. So the reorganization, what we're doing is to currently just sort out the ex-mine workers and the current mine workers and reorganize them and get a better system and a deal, and that's part of the discussion I'm having with the settlement colleagues in terms of the whole issue. The flaw in the Act is Department of Labor Quaida system, the levy covers the cost of administration, the cost of health care, and the cost of delivery of the income protection fund. Our fund only covers the cost of income protection, albeit flawed in terms of its benefits. The cost of administration is borne by the state. The cost of health care is borne by the state, the provision of oxygen, etc. So these are issues that we're going to sort out in the fraud system as we take forward in terms of the reorganization of the system. So let me just deal with then some two or three issues then to take forward the size of the problem. I've got the slides. Between 1.2 million and 2 million ex-mine workers, we suspect that 600,000 have died, unfortunately. 300,000 ex-mine workers in Eastern Cape, 120,000 in Lesotho, 80,000, we didn't have this data before, 80,000 in Mozambique, 30,000 in Swaziland. So this is the size and quantum of the problem in terms of service delivery. We have engaged as the Ministry of Health, both by my minister, both to multilaterals and bilaterals at the SADC. We had a SADC meeting virtually 3 weeks ago in Polokwane, where this issue of occupational TB silicosis was also raised. We've just come back from Moscow on the declaration on TB in the world by the ministers of health, addressed by President Putin. We put silica dust exposure onto the agenda in terms of mine workers. So one of the issues was the fact that we negotiate in terms of multilaterals and bilaterals, both in terms of the presidency, and unfortunately the colleague from the presidency had to leave. But we are part of an interministerial committee with Minister Adeba about how do we deal with the restructure of the mining industry. So one of the issues was that, unfortunately, Mr. Kulu, we have to, the government, neighboring country governments have wanted us to pay the compensation fund to them. Our law doesn't allow us to pay monies to anybody other than the actual claimant. We can't deal with third parties, whether it's governments or et cetera. So that's why we have put in these systems into the countries, and they're quite happy with the processes. In fact, Mozambique, one of the places will be opened by the Minister of Health of Mozambique in Shashai this coming Saturday, the one-stop service center that I talked about, et cetera. So we are negotiated. We've done the transfers. There are big issues around access to financial services, which is another issue we have to deal with. Banking the unbankable. We have to pay bank accounts. We are not like SASA where we can do cash payments. We have to pay into bank accounts. Access to bank accounts by mine workers has been a major problem, and we are dealing with that as well as a meeting to deal with the banking industry. So let me stop there just to say that we are reorganizing the legislation. We've reorganized the system, and we've delivered the numbers gain. And we've reorganized the process of service delivery. On the class action, we've been in discussions with both parties, and we've spelled out principles from our side. Firstly, there should not be parallel systems. The previous trust that was set up had complete parallel systems, and we are saying that can we work together in terms of this process? We should create confusion for the people on the ground. Parallel systems of certification, parallel systems of administration, etc. And the second issue was how do we strengthen the apparatus to deliver a better life for people. Lastly, prevention is important, and hence we salute the Department of Mineral Resources in trying to do more on prevention. We think a lot more needs to be done. I've disagreed with the occupational exposure limit of 0.1. I raised that as long ago as 5 to 10 years ago. And Canada, Australia, etc. are sitting at 0.05. And my view about giving the industry 5 to 10 years grace is not on. There's still workers being exposed. The group around this table might be getting to lower levels. But right now, I think there's also problems. We're picking up 40% of the workers that are coming to our one-stop service centers have got noise-induced hearing loss. So we're sitting on some major epidemics. And Chair, we need to intervene now decisively. Otherwise, future generations will hold us as we did now with the 100-year problem. So OELs and threshold limit levels, you know, diesel particulate emissions, we've got a lot more work to do. We're going to be concentrating on a flawed system with TB. So one of the issues of our new levy system is going to take into account TB incidence rates, injury frequency rates, and we're going to maneuver the system because ours takes too long to develop. But we'll be able to get acute care and then mobilize the levy rates in our system based on the past incidents and help the companies where it's most in terms of the levy changes to them. Thanks, Chair.
It's a little bit scary, the last Thanks, Doc. Honorable members, before I deal with the what we should look at it as a way forward, I'm a very fair person. Honorable Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure, but I suppose
I would have suggested this, and I know it's a bit logistical. Let me, you've got a right to object to what I'm going to say. I'm worried the DM is not here. There is an immediate issue, and I must say that's why I would have loved that he is present. And it's not on the merits or demerits. It's about to deal with the question of political leadership. There's a process that is happening which relate to the industry, which seems to be going completely outside political guidance. Like I'm hearing it for the first time sitting here, because I've been just seeing people, but I'm just saying it would have been much better for the committee to say what becomes this attitude on the issues that were raised, which is, allow me to use that word advisedly because I'm a lay person. The legal dispute that is between the mining companies as well as the law firms. And it seems they will find one another. I'm just hypothetically looking at it. And I think it would be too difficult for you, Babu Zondi, to help us on that. It seems there is a matter that is in and out of the courts, and if it's being settled, it will be settled by the parties. Then the question is, where is political guidance in that process? I hear the chamber, at least to some degree. I'm not congratulating the chamber, but I'm saying to some degree, they're a little bit closer. I know it's because it's their members, some of them. They're a little bit closer. They do have a clue of the processes. Now, I'm just saying, if that, let's putting it positively, if these parties were to find one another, it seems like it will be the courts that will say, yes, you've done very well, and it's left like that. So that's why I would, because one of the major issues was that we may not know what will be the economic implications if you don't agree. So although I get a sense that both sides, there is a little bit of trying to move closer. So that is the first part, which to me I thought, because part of the work that is being done, leave the advices that are being given, but these are legal firms that are representing. And as a committee, I don't think we can live here and say, oh, okay, we have heard you, and that's it. So I think that's the first, the immediate issue. Without entering, because that's what we're not, I think it will be incorrect. We don't want to enter the question of what is in the court papers and so forth and so forth. Listening to both these presentations from Mr. Spoor and Mr. Kulu, there are a little bit of detail that gives the background. That will then ask a question. The first one is historical matters, whether was there legal compliance or non-legal compliance. Then there's a liability matter, which whether there was compliance with the prescribed regime laws at that moment. But there's a, so I'm just saying, when I look, trying to put these things together, at some point there has to be. The second thing is the issues that now relate to your agenda to transform the industry, specifically on some of the areas that would say inherently we're dehumanizing exercises. To what extent do you cause it? Then there is a bigger problem, which is why I said they are saying this thing is a little bit scary. The question of legislative framework. When I came here, I only had a thought of the three compensation systems. Now I can see there is an issue about the health and safety legislative framework, whether you need separate or you need one, and so forth. These are mandate issues. Then there is an issue that I was saying, which we have not gone into details, by the way, on the cases. There is an establishment of non-statutory entities in the form of the trust and so forth, which are expected to control and take charge. You know the problem, that, and the reason I'm raising this thing, honorable member, in the final analysis, whatever happens, it's going to boil back to the state. Let's assume, I'm not saying that's what will happen, Mr. Sport and your team and Mr. Kuhn. But if something goes amiss, the first people who have to account, it will surely fall squarely on the shoulders of Parliament and government. The establishment of the, which we have not dealt with even ourselves, is something that we might still be owing. The disappearance of money in the dear account, whatever you call it, in the Northwest, it's not necessarily far from what role the government and so forth play. So I'm just saying the proximity to me on these whole issues might be, from a my chair's point of view, when Babunandaba, you are presenting, all of you, let me forgive the doctor, the commissioner. I can't get a sense of how much the department is in charge of this development. That's why I'm saying it's a political matter. We should be able to say, no. When Mr. Spohr woke up and said, look, there is a case here. Let me take these gold companies head on. And Mr. Kulu also followed suit. It was, okay, let them continue with their battle. What are the political implications? That is the duty that we have from a committee point of view. So that's why I was saying I'm worried that if we think we can finish these things today, as you were speaking, Dr. Kandisan, as you were speaking, now I was asking, and we always, you know, politicians, we always run away from things that will pin us down. Do we think a one-day meeting will be sufficient enough as a solution, trying to deal with the issues that we're dealing with as a solution? Can I ask a question from all the members? Now I'm sitting, I've got someone who has got an experience. I'm not questioning what you were saying, Babu Kulu. Sometimes voluntary service may not be something that we easily believe. But there are broader issues that we'll have to deal with then. One of those is in the trace, someone was talking about the ex-mine workers, their widows. We'll have to deal with that thing. To what extent do you trace or do you deal with the widows? Some of those widows, I can tell you now, from the point of my cousin, by the time he passed away, which could be part of what you are talking about, he had already been divorced. So we'll have to deal with those things. Do you trace from the point then? So there could be other complex issues that will arise out of that settlement. Whether that settlement is by arbitrary processes, which is the courts of law, or by voluntary consensus that happens. When that process of starting now to talk about claims, the issues will arise even about entitlement, especially if the other one is deceased. So that's why I was saying, honorable members, I'm even if we're to ask questions, we must know if we ask questions from the team of Babu Kulu or Babu Spor or from our dear friends, not to always punish them when they come here. The department, it will take long. My worry, I could tell you that maybe we should consider reconvening. You have made your presentations, but there is only one thing that we are interested in, especially from the department, is to get guidance politically. Request the deputy minister, especially not, this one he can lead us on the interventions that are being made. Either the deputy minister or the minister, or even the DG, unfortunately, I think, but he must take the, they say when you buy a car, you put toots. Yes, it takes everything. is that the DG must come and tell us what are they doing in relation to this. We will politic on it, because to me, once you have got people who must go and find each other outside, then it actually means the we are on autopilot. You see? That is where the TEF, I always say, I appreciate. Anything that happens, at least I must, at least if they found solution, I must get credit that I was part of helping to find the solution. That's what, if it gets messed up, at least I must say, no, they don't want to find each other. Someone must be arrogant and so forth. So I don't take the blame, but I take the credit. That's the thing that is jealous. Shouldn't we, now the problem I said, from Dublin, we can't pay that ticket. Let alone it could be costly to pay. At least Babukulu, we can look at how many. The problem you said is volunteering. So as an outreach lawyer, it actually means it's not losing a cent during the day. So it's be doing this work that it's doing normally. Except if it's clashing with a big, big, big project. But I'll just assume, because it's in Cape Town, if he can have, if he's unavailable or you're unavailable, if we can get someone who can be able to rise to the level of your submission. I beg lawyers. There's a reason. It's like a doctor. Even if you didn't ask them to call you, they call you and then they bill you for the call that they've made to you. So, Mr. Spohr, and your team, if we were to get, I know you are three separate legal entities, but if we were to just avail yourself, and at least now you've got a sense also, you have talked to us, you are unlike the first time when you come in. I know when you make the first presentation, there are things you hold yourself. But when you go back, be prepared to answer questions for us. But also be prepared to tell us, what do you want us to do? What do you expect from this? We said we're a caring government. What do you want us to do? We will tell you if we can and if we can't. My two doctors, you are summoned to be here next week, Wednesday. I'm just worried about one thing. Yes, you were going to present, by the way, next week, so you are someone to be here on that day where you were supposed to be here. My last worry, and I must say this thing, Jasmine, it's not that I like traveling. No, I must say this thing openly. It's not that I like traveling. Thank you for the information, Doc. We will deal with the office of Kasmin, because it's the DM. I won't beat about the bush, except if others know. I was not even aware about the launch in Bakersfield. I didn't know even this one. So I can't take in Parliament the simplest rule so that you can leave these walls, or even use your own. You must get an invitation and then decide on the delegation and then apply. I want to explain this thing, because sometimes people think you just come and then you apply, then the house chair must grant you the right to go and attend. Please, Babu Khasmin, because these members, I must say it now, they may think that, oh, he had the invitation and he didn't tell us that we were being invited. No. We request this thing. That's why I say sometimes we may be of help to some of these activities. Lastly, we will take your, I think this one is voluntary, your advice. We just have to see how do we deal. We have tried by it, but it's so difficult for the three committees. It's so difficult. I will try and bring you closer so that you can be my unpaid special advisor on these three issues. Do we agree on that, honorable members, that when we start next week, we must start with the deputy minister who is heading this project, including the attitude of the department in relation to the dispute that exists, which is an immediate matter, and then give us then a rundown in terms of the other processes that seeks to redress the previous disadvantages that our people were subjected to. Is that okay, honorable members? Honorable Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a lighter note, I think we know why attorneys speak long because they're called by the hour. We know why businessmen don't speak long because time is money. But I just wonder why politicians are not down to time or money. They've been keeping us busy for nearly 25 minutes, Mr. Chair.
Then on a lighter note, on a more serious note, could we just ask Dr. Tammy just to put what he has said in a framework, very rough framework? I think you seem to have some form of idea what the overall structure should look like, and it would be informative to judge what's been said against what your view should be. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any second?
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I wish to second the recommendation. I think today it was really an eye-opener to some of us on these matters. They are really serious. So this meeting of today, it was quite decent, and you can't just finish it in one go. I think the chair is correct. I think we had also to apply our mind on issues raised, whatever, so that when we speak here, we're able to speak as a multi-party, as a PC committee with one voice. So that's what I think, Chair, I need to say. Thank you very much.
Okay. I won't say now I understand when lawyers are converted into politicians, they speak less because they won't be paid. Okay. Thank you very much. You, not the committee, are released until next week, Wednesday, same time. 9. We will inform you of the venue. We might have to finish some other stuff of ours, but we still have to agree in terms of the procedure. Some stuff of ours as a committee, and then start with the work. Honorable members, can we now go to the minutes? This is the... Okay. Okay. No, it's okay.
We're going out to that place now this afternoon.
Okay. No invoice.
No.
Okay, go. Okay. Sure. Check. Sure. Okay. Okay. We're not dismissing you, Zagate. Okay. Honorable members, can we deal with the minutes, which is the 8th and the 15th of November? Page one. They are very short, ne? Page two. Okay. Any more? Any more, Honorable Nyambe?
Thank you, Chairperson. I move for the adoption of this minutes of the 8th November 2017 as a true reflection. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Second?
Thank you, Chair. I wish to second, Chair.
Any matters arising? Can I clarify something so that when we arrive there, even if you didn't see it, let me make you see. When you arrive there, can we take the matter, which is a matter arising number four? Yes. Number four, especially bullet point two. The reason I'm saying this, honorable members, at the time, which is on the 15th, we were supposed to take, we couldn't take resolutions, which is why we didn't adopt the minutes. But we placed the matter as an announcement. So I'm just saying, can you agree that we will deal with that matter when we deal with the minutes of the 15th? Is that agreed? Okay. Okay, let's go to the minutes of the 15th. Page one. Page two. Page three. You're long, ne? Unlike your usual. Page four. Page five. Page six. Page seven. Is there any mover? Besides that, your name might be there. Just look as to whether, at the time of taking decisions, you are present. I know I nearly detained Honorable Rima when he made the apology. Any mover? Honorable Pigeon.
Thank you very much, sir. I wish to move, sir, that you.
Any seconder? Honorable Nyambi.
Chairperson, I second.
Okay. Matters arising, can I raise two issues, which the first one, not necessarily a matter that adds to its. Okay, let me find a better one. Not a controversial matter. probably. The issue that we raised, and I think we must say, Babu Unondaba, from the department, who might be the executive authority. When the CGS came to present here, in fact, it was raised by me, not that I'm saying as an individual, that that issue that they came to present is a very serious matter. It's about finding funding and so forth. Now, it was almost the second time that the chair of the board would not, you must understand, one, we're dealing with the BRRR, which again had the request for funding. This time around, we're calling them specifically on the request for additional funding and the money that then Treasury had made as a consideration, although it was a little bit minimal to compared to the expectation. So we're just saying sometimes when you come to, when these things come in, not that we question an ordinary board member that can attend, but we just hope it's not going to be a trend. Because tomorrow when there's accountability, someone will say, no, it was never reported like that. We just say when people are elected to chair, we're appointed, especially take responsibility to chair. Oh, tomorrow we'll not be surprised that that money, instead of going to what was intended to, finds itself in somewhere else in terms of the expenditure. So it's an accountability matter that I think we needed to do. The second one is the one that we talked about. It stands Tuesday, but the reason we had to put, and I think to some degree, thank you, honorable members, we have moved a little bit. The concern we were having was that next week is the last time as a committee we meet. So giving the other two to make the presentation in terms of the lawyers and not bring in those who represent employers or former employers an opportunity. So that's why we're trying to push that all of them, even yourselves, unaware, find must be able to make this input. So it means now next week we'll be dealing with the questions, which is on Tuesday, finalizing the questions to the minister. And we're saying if we finish on time, we'll then have to deal with the way forward at the same time. If we are not finishing at the same time, we will then come back on Wednesday and deal with the way forward, which I hope and hopefully within an hour or so will be done, and then we will go back to the outstanding work of today that we're dealing with, and then be able to say at least there's something that we are coming out of that in a more consolidated way. We will invite the Parliamentary Legal Service so that they can be able to also help to guide us on what then will constitute or can constitute the way forward. But finally, the decision rests with this committee on what they will have to do. That is why I dealt with the two issues that I think, but members can have a take on the matter, on the matters arising, including these ones that I've talked to. I'm not saying matters arising are the only two. I'm just saying there could be others that you want to raise as matters arising, but also you can have a take on these two. Honorable Schmidt?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm sure we'll try and finish off by Tuesday the questions to the minister. And then we can continue with the discussion if needs be. If we are finished, by all means, we can continue with the discussion on Tuesday. But it seems to me Wednesday's issues, I was under the impression that it was initially just a presentation on this poor, let's call it the class action matter, but it seems to have grown with the addition of Kulu attorneys, and then seems to have grown with a general discussion as to the process and the surrounding issues, with Dr. Sammy adding to it. So seems to have grown into a monster, and I think the monstrosity of the complexity of that matter, if I could add those two adjectives, seems to be quite an intricate matter. So maybe it's good to discuss it then on Wednesday and see where it can lead you. But, you know, we discuss issues over every so often, but we don't get pointers. We need pointers to where it should go. And I think Dr. Sammy is in a good position to indicate to us how it should, not the finer detail, but how it should overall look like. Short term, long term, all into one, whatever, different categories. Thank you.
Okay. In fact, it should be. We made that point in passing. It should be taken as a resolution of the committee that we will require more of detail of that in a more presentation form, which means in a document form, so that it could help members to have a very channeled, zoomed in discussion. I think that's what you're saying.
To resolve issues relating to the class action, the Zulu summons that have been issued, the wider ranging non-claiming of benefits at the ex-mine workers organization, that's been going on
for 10 years, if not longer. So how does one resolve all these issues? Seems to be where we're heading at. So it's not just one, let's call it cause of action, not just one problem. There are various problems that need to be guided through the process.
Okay. Having done all this work, thank you very much again, honorable members, the two departments, I guess, because I didn't see labor, for your contribution, hopefully and wishfully, see you next week, Wednesday. The meeting stands adjourned. Now I'm talking about the department. You'll see them Wednesday. No, you must tell us in a subject then. Which one is it? Oh, Lena, Baban.
Yamba Yong. Yamba, what's Yamba Yong?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Brad Janji.
Sorry, it's not coming from my minister's invitation, but I sent it because of the time.